This week in Retronauts, Jeremy Parrish shakes up a can of beer that explodes in Stuart Gyp's hand, necessitating a hospital visit in which the various hosts of Retronauts visit him to remember past episodes, or something. Hello, welcome to Retronauts, being hosted by me, Stuart Gyp, otherwise known as the British one off of Retronauts. Today we've got something of a loosey-goosey, nice and juicy episode in which myself and my esteemed guest, who I will introduce momentarily while they sit there awkwardly on their hands, will discuss a very fine subject, which is compilations. I was going to say the subject, and I stumbled over my words, and I've just instantly ruined the episode. Anyway, joining me for the first time on Retronauts, but hopefully not the last, is the proprietor of SegaDriven.com, which is both an excellent website, blog, and YouTube channel showcasing lesser-known, lesser-seen games. In fact, why don't you explain it? It's Lewis Clark. Hello, Lewis.
Hello. Yeah. Thank you very much for having us on. I'm the webmaster and lead writer at SegaDriven.com, which is a Sega news and Sega history blog and website, I guess. Try and catalogue a load of hardware and game stuff and merchandise and things and just whatever takes my fancy, really. And I have an accompanying YouTube channel where I basically do the exact same thing. Whatever takes my fancy, I'll make a video on, and it just seems to always be something weirder and more obscure as time goes on. I've covered things like weird Sega knockoffs on different systems, essentially. I've been fascinated by, you know, just the stranger side of their back catalog, and obviously retro stuff in particular, which is probably why you asked me to be on this one, because we're talking about retro compilations. Hey.
Oh, yeah, I only just got that connection. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yesterday we're talking about compilations, which is a subject that, if you've been following my writing on Retronauts.com, you'll know why I'm sort of madly obsessed with.
Mm.
Because there's nothing better than a repackaging of old video games in new skin. It is just the best thing ever. Whenever a retro compilation comes out, I just become inordinately excited.
Mm.
And it's been a bit of a renaissance period for them in the last few years. Thanks to Digital Eclipse.
Absolutely.
Coming out with their banger compilations. What I'll note at this point is, as I said, this is going to be quite a loose, informal sort of discussion. This is not like a actual potted history of a retro compilation.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some comments that I don't explain enough the thing that we're talking about.
Yeah.
We did a Lemmings episode recently, me and Dave Bulmer, and I got some comments like, why don't you explain what Lemmings is? The reason I didn't do that, I guess I figured I thought everyone knew what Lemmings was, but
yeah.
I'll do it now. I'll explain the basic premise of a retro compilation for the listeners, which is repackaging. This is kind of an out there example, but the most prominent one is probably Super Mario All-Stars, even though it's not a true retro compilation in a sense.
Mm.
It's bringing together Super Mario Brothers and etc. together in one cartridge. That's what a compilation is. One CD with many old games on it, and sometimes some extras. A good place to start, because I don't want to get into the whole Sinclair Spectrum.
There's compilation. So much home computer stuff, isn't there, where it's just like a big compilation included with your brand new Amiga or whatever, and it's just like,
yeah,
that's great and all, but I think we're kind of trying to focus on, maybe a generation older,
so
that it feels more like an actual throwback, essentially, compilation.
But we couldn't ignore Mega Games.
Mega Games 1 is like one of my first games. I got my Mega Drive in the Christmas of 1991, and it came with a copy of Sonic 1 and Mega Games 1. And then I proceeded to get all of those collections. There's three of them. Well, there's technically more, because there's some weird six-pack versions which came much later. But the first three are basically the core sort of basis of it. And they're just a great way to get a load of first-party Sega games for a budget price.
I'm assuming that this is a dumb thing, but I'm assuming in America they were still called Mega Games. Like, they didn't rename it, like, Jenny Games or something.
So, I know for a fact that the first one actually does have a different name in America.
Oh, really?
Which is a bit strange. I think if I... Let me just quickly check it, because...
Yeah, sure.
It's a bit, like, out there in comparison.
Yeah. These are 92 and 93 instantly.
This is it, yeah. So the first one is called Triple Score, three games in one.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. What's wrong with these people?
Just Mega Games, right? I suppose you know, they have to rename it because they don't have the Mega Drive out there. But
yeah, well, just don't rename the Mega Drive. Call it the Mega Drive because it's a cooler
exactly,
name.
Exactly, right? The Mega Drive, it's called the Mega Drive in more places than the rest of the world, so why is bloody Genesis there?
Is the console a book of the Bible? No. Is it a band... at one point fronted by Phil Collins. No, it's not. So
exactly that. So yeah.
I wish it was sometimes, but
I suppose the real highlight of these is Mega Games 2. Basically just gives you three of the absolute best first party Sega Mega Drive games. So you get Golden Axe, Streets of Rage and Revenge of Shinobi, all classics, all worth your
time. I didn't have this experience, but I think about what it would be like as a child to receive that for Christmas or something.
You would not play anything else for just, you know, months, essentially. You're sorted. I mean, I have nostalgia for the first one, Column, Super Hang-On and World Cup Italia 90, but it's got to be said that there's only really one game there that I would say is great, and that's probably Super Hang-On. And then Mega Games 3 I also like because I'm a big fan of Alien Storm, another great Sega beat-em-up.
Alien Storm's awesome.
But it's also got Super Monaco GP on it and Super Thunder Blade, which is toss. Nothing to write home about on Mega Games 3, really. But
Super Thunder Blade, that's the no version of that, like home version, apart from... Wait, there was the 3DS version, wasn't there?
That's technically just Thunder Blade. Super Thunder Blade is technically a sequel.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, it's not a great game. The Mega Drive can't reproduce the Super Scalar sort of, like, you know.
No, it's a bummer.
Graphics. So it makes it look really horrible and stilted as, like, you know, sprites trying to draw themselves in closer to the camera, and it just looks really wrong.
and other than some, here and there, sort of 2-in-1 compilations, like the Codemasters compilations and things.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say, we've already mentioned it briefly, but the next, I would say, major game compilation, the one that really put them on the map, to be honest, was Super Mario All-Stars.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, of course, the revision that came out, which also added World, which made it one of the most... arguably one of the most banger cartridges ever made.
That cartridge is insane. Like, the fact that you're getting, 1, 2, 3 Lost Levels and Super Mario World on one cartridge, that's
the only
value for money.
The only downer for Mario All-Stars for me, and whenever I talk about this, I honestly think people are going to try and find where I live and hit me. This is quite well known, but for Mario Brothers and Lost Levels, they changed the way that bricks break. When you hit them, you're supposed to bounce straight off them downwards, like with momentum, like it would prang you back down almost. And in this, they don't. You keep going up through them. So when you're running hit a brick, you can get hitched on the side of a block.
You lose your momentum, essentially.
You lose momentum. And it turns out that it really was, like, someone went into the code and found out it really was just like a 1 where there should have been a 0.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Holy crap.
Yeah, and that fixes it. And... it's such a prominent error that whenever this cartridge comes up as like, okay, very famously in UK magazine, game magazine media, the popular Nintendo magazine Total, had a cover which was just a massive silver, like platinum, 99%. We reviewed this game, it got 99%.
Okay.
Which is like an absurd score, if you're familiar with how scores work. But for me, like, I reviewed this for Nintendo Life and I got shouted at because I gave it a 7. And the reason I gave it a 7 is because the NES versions are still better.
Absolutely. I mean, like, they're mechanically the correct thing that you're expecting to play, right?
Yeah. Mario 2 is fine, Mario 3 is fine, and Mario World is fine. But in terms of movement, Mario 2 to me is the only... I mean, I would rather play All-Stars Mario 2 than NES Mario 2 because I think it is an all-round visual improvement and it plays exactly the same.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mario 3, it plays great, but I don't like the overhaul. It makes some of the more abstract levels look kind of boring.
I can see that.
But it's still a banger cartridge.
Absolutely,
and Mario World has been slightly revised as well. Like, I think Luigi, they made him actually have unique sprites.
Yeah, he's got a lot more character. He does, like, knee slides and stuff. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's a good one.
Yeah, it is an absolute banger, and it's really strange that the Wii re-release later on that came out for the anniversary doesn't include Mario World. It's just like, why not
That re-release is just, like, that's what people... I don't like saying this because it's not a criticism I think has any validity, but that's what people are talking about when they talk about a ROM dump.
Yeah, yeah, no,
for sure. Because I think it more or less is just the SNES version running on disk, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially under emulation. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, again, like, emulation is important. Let's not be around the bush. Like, it's incredibly important. And especially when we get to a certain era in our list, like, it's so imperative to basically running all of these games on more modern hardware and, you know, not having to individually reprogram them like we're seeing with this collection in particular.
Yes,
because you get the authentic experience via emulation. Like, all right, yes, it may introduce some input lag, but it's negligible for having an absolute banger of a compilation full of absolute, you know, just a huge list of games, which, you know, will come in time.
I've got a prediction that the both of us are going to say the phrase "absolute banger" about 1,000 times.
Oh, yeah.
On this episode. It's the new hotness. It's the new hotness. So, 3 years later, you got to tell me about this one, because I'm not actually familiar with it. I watched your video about it.
Yeah,
Williams Arcade Classics for Mega Drive and Game.com, 96. And I bought this on the strength of your video, because I was amazed they managed to make such an authentic-looking Robotron on Mega Drive. I haven't played it yet, though, so you got to tell us about this.
Well, so we're going to sing their praises a lot throughout this video, but this was developed by Digital Eclipse, one of their first arcade, you know, compilations. It was originally released in America as Williams Arcade Classics, but by the time it got PAL release, the merger with Midway had happened. So they renamed it Midway Arcade Classics for the PAL regions. And yeah, you get Defender 2, also known as Stargate, Joust, Robotron 2084, and Sinistar.
That is wild.
That's a great compilation right there, and it plays surprisingly well. Even Robotron, which you can enhance on the 6-button Mega Drive pad by pressing the mode button, and it kind of gives you an approximation of a second stick.
Yeah, so wait, with that it would be like... Y is up, fire. A is left, B is down, C is right.
Essentially.
That sounds really good.
It's tough to get used to, but you do click with it eventually. The reason why I wanted to talk about the Gamecom version as well in particular is that port is also surprisingly good, because the Gamecom actually has a diamond configuration for its face buttons, which means it's quite natural to use that as a second stick for Robotron.
That sounds like it might be the best Gamecom game.
It probably is, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
The only thing that it really suffers from is the fact that the Gamecom screen is ghosty as all hell. So, like, as you move around, it's not too bad for games like Robotron and Joust, where it's fixed screen. But stuff like Defender obviously gets very ghosty as it moves around. But it's a surprising little compilation. And it also has a different front end to the Mega Drive version. The Mega Drive version's menu is very bare bones, whereas the Gamecom one has, like, you basically walk into a little arcade and all the games are, like, presented as cabinets, which you select. So that's really fun. That's probably one of the earliest times I think I've ever seen, like, an arcade-style presentation for a menu.
Yeah, that's a motif that keeps coming back as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, a surprisingly good little port, considering.
So that the Mega Drive version, just real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
That's got to be reprogrammed. That can't be emulation, surely.
Absolutely not. No, it's not.
Yeah,
they're
new versions.
It's
just
very good interpretations of... They probably, you know, just had to eyeball them using actual arcade hardware and just be like, okay, this is how this is supposed to feel, I guess. They most likely didn't have source code to work with. So, especially built with it being it wasn't developed in-house by Williams or Midway.
Yeah.
A really good early arcade compilation, well worth checking out.
Yeah, and the next year on Saturn, also on Saturn, well, I was about to say also on Sega, I've obviously made that clear now.
Yeah.
One of the most beloved compilations, Sonic Jam.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, it sets the bar so high that like even the most recent Sonic Origins compilation feels like a bit of a step down from Sonic Jam.
Yes. I mean, Sonic, we'll get to it, but Sonic has a really checkered history for me with compilations. And Sonic Jam, I mean, Sonic Jam has its own problems. It has its own bugs.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But it also has its own bug fixes, which is kind of mad.
Yeah. Because it's, again, it's ports. This is not emulation. No. These are ports of these games. And they add, I mean, you've got Sonic 2, Sonic 3, and Sonic & Knuckles, which you can then respectively lock on to each game in a really nice little menu where you physically have to actually lock it on.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
I really like. But what makes it interesting, other than the major feature which we'll talk about, is you've got your choice of, what is it, like original, normal, and easy.
Yes, yeah.
And original is the unmolested, like exactly as they were on the Mega Drive.
Yeah, but version. The normal mode is like a bug fixed version, which like changes some bits. Almost, so to make it a little bit more fair. Like one of my favorite things it does is in the second act of Green Hill Zone on Sonic 1, there is a section where there's some sort of like some platforms that move up and down, and underneath them is a pit. And in the original game, it's like instant death. They block those pits up on the Sonic Jams version, because I'm assuming they just feel like that's a little bit unfair in the first stage of the game to give you an instant death, you know?
Yeah, because you can fall between the spikes and
essentially,
just die, can't you?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. So yeah, again, that's just a nice little touch and a little bit of like a quality of life improvement that this game does.
The one that I remember is the fact they got rid of the troll pit in Mystic Cave.
Yeah,
where you can't get out. They put a spring in there, the Leptute Legends.
No, absolutely. And if I remember correctly, don't they get rid of the barrel from Sonic 3? Like, just straight up, it's just gone. Like, yeah, that's unfair. Like,
I stand against that. That's an act of cowardice. That barrel should be there, because the barrel sorts the men from the boys, to use an outdated gendered expression. I whenever people talk about having trouble with the barrel, I'm just like, don't be so stupid. It's so obvious what you do. How can you not figure this out? I get genuinely salty about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the way people play games now and the way we used to play games, where you would just try stuff and see what happens, is just something that, like, I think people do need to be spoon-fed a little bit more nowadays.
Well, I got on the barrel. I remember playing it as a kid, and I was jumping on the barrel, and I'm like, well, this isn't working. What have I got? The only other input's on this controller.
Well, there you go.
The willingness to try stuff out. I just don't think it's that difficult.
Yeah, no, this is the thing. I mean, like, God, I must have grown up with so many, like, weird imports and just sort of, like, mucked around with them to figure out how to work it, because I couldn't understand the bloody language.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just the way of the world, isn't it? We shouldn't not mention Sonic World in Sonic Jam as well.
Oh, yeah, that's the major feature I alluded to. Sonic's World, the big polygon blocky 3D take on the museum, which is really rather cool.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff in the museum that I believe is still completely unexplained. To this, like, there's a theater you can go to, like a cinema, where you can watch this utterly bizarre and expensive looking cartoon.
Man of the Year. Incredible stuff. Like, God knows what it was developed for, but well worth a watch. And again, a huge shame that it's just not in Sonic Origins. Like, why would you not include that?
my personal assumption is that the cartoon Man of the Year was possibly one of the pilot pitches for Sonic Adventures Sonic the Hedgehog. That's my assumption.
I could see that.
Because it does share, I think it shares Sonic's design with that. I might be wrong. I've not seen it for a while. But it's not just that, obviously. There's like a gallery of pictures from like the Sonic screensaver and stuff, which do turn up in everything else.
Absolutely.
But they're cute pictures, so it's okay.
No, that video gallery in particular is just a fascinating little thing. There's all the, you know, Japanese commercials and things in there, and like a weird deleted like ride that was supposed to happen, like a VR style ride. And you can just watch the video of that never released.
That's just so cool.
It's just wicked stuff.
I mean, when I was a kid, it was the first time I'd seen like the Japanese covers for the games as well.
Oh yeah, totally.
And the pop art, amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just a great compilation.
That's a nice little touch as well. Like the different ports of Sonic Jam in like US, PAL region and Japan. When you're in the game menu, like the cartridges will show their local, like artwork.
Good.
Which is something that doesn't get replicated a lot with later compilations down the line.
I guess the only thing I can think of is the Mega Drive Mini, which does do that, but only when you change it yourself.
Absolutely. Like, but we'll get to some bits where that doesn't happen, and it's just, you can tell, like, this was made on a budget. There was not the attention and love given to it that something like Sonic Jam has had.
And like Sonic Jam, we'll move on from it, but it is a compilation that has essentially set a benchmark for Sonic compilations that they have consistently failed to reach.
Absolutely.
Not that they haven't been without their charms, but we'll get to it, obviously. But
yeah.
A little bit of an obscure one we should talk about briefly is the 1998 Saturn Konami Antiques MSX Collection Ultra Pack.
Which is probably one of the greatest names for a video game ever.
It really is. And it's what it is it's a collection of either two or three, I forget, MSX compilations that were released on the PS1.
Okay.
But what you get a big sample of games. There must be over 20. I'm not going to list them.
Yeah.
But, like, all of the versions of Gradius, including Nemesis 2, which is an absolutely amazing, brilliant shmup.
Yep.
Stuff like and the MSX version of Proteus is super fun as well. But even stuff like Twinbee, Antarctic Adventure.
Yep.
And the fact you're getting so many games just on the one disc for the Saturn makes it a bit of an essential, I think.
Yeah, I didn't know this existed until you put it in the list, and I was just like,
yeah,
that's going on the emulator later. Obviously, I will acquire it legally and then delete it within 24 hours.
Within 24 hours, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
I don't think that I knew this existed until I went researching. Like, I knew that the PS1 games were, because you can still buy them if you have a Japanese account on PS3.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
But, yeah, I've talked about it on a previous episode, but the Japanese PS3 store is, like, the most ridiculous surplus of riches for retro gaming ever. There's, like, 400, 500 PS1 games on there. That's like,
insane.
Including fully English ones that never got brought over here for some unknown bloody reason.
Yeah, what a shame. But yeah, no, this is a real, like, little highlight of a package. And one of the things I really like about retro compilations is it's basically just like, well, here's a guide essentially to a console or a system that you've never experienced before. I mean, I have no experience with an MSX, so this would be a lovely thing to just sort of like go through and just explore. Because, yeah, there's a really wide list of games here. And
There's no context necessarily, but that you do get all these great games to try out, and they're not particularly complex games either. So.
Well, this is the joy of just old arcade games, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very easy to just pick up and play. Yeah, no, that's definitely getting checked out after we record today. Definitely having a look at that.
Yeah. Speaking of arcade compilations, not that we were, Namco Museum series beginning in 1995, running through to 1997. Now, I am staggered that this got fully done, considering that
this is
some of the
so
games
niche,
they start collecting.
Like, yeah.
By the end, like, they're clinging desperately to Pac-Man games.
Oh, yeah.
And I am not saying that those games are bad.
No, I'm
saying that they're saving up Pac-Man games to throw in, like, Volume 4, like, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, Pac-Land.
Yeah, I love Pac-Land, but the games that it's on there with, like, I'm not saying they're bad games, but people didn't know what these games were.
No.
Like, the retro gaming was not what it is now.
But I think that's why I find Volume 4 and 5 in particular very fascinating. For me personally, I think the PS1 Namco Museums are the high bar for retro compilations. Because the early ones, you get the classics, right? So you get a lovely little selection of games. You get your Pac-Mans, you get your Galagas, you get your Xevious, you get your Mappies and stuff. So yeah, it's what you expect. But they have this awesome presentation where they're complete ports. They're not emulated, but they have the arcade board's dip switches as an option that you can muck around with in every single game. You have a virtual museum you can explore in first person, which is an insane level of presentation that just nobody goes to at all. And yeah, when you get to Volume 4 and 5, you get the weird stuff, which is even better. So one of the games on Volume 4 is Genpei Tomoden, which gets localized for the first time ever on Namco Museum Volume 4 as the Genji and Heike clans, which is just a bizarre sort of like samurai horror kind of platformer, but it also changes into a beat 'em up and also a top-down thing. Really cool game. And then Namco Museum Volume 5 has The Legend of Valkyrie, which is a localized version of Valkyrie no Densetsu. An absolute all-timer as far as I'm concerned. Really great game. That doesn't really get a lot of love. One of my favorite soundtracks in any video game ever as well. Really cool stuff. Like, just, but like, it, again, like you say, it, you could say that it was scraping the bottom of the barrel, but I like that it goes that weird, you know?
Yeah. I mean, to what, from one perspective, like, yeah, I mean, to me, not so much, because I know quite a lot of these games, and like, Namco Museum Encore, which is the one of the Japan-only ones. I think there was one other one as well, but I might be wrong about that.
Namco Museum Encore is a little bit... That one's more like, you know, your budget retro compilation. It doesn't have the first-person explorative.
It does have Skykin and Rolling Thunder, so...
this is the thing, right? I love Skykin. It's still got some bangers in there. Yeah, I love Motos as well, which is another inclusion on that one. So, yeah,
I discovered Skykid writing a thing for a Retronauts thing, and I never played it before, and I was just like... This is great. Like, this is a really weirdly complex but very playable shmup with great music. Yeah,
that's the joy of exploring Namco stuff, to be honest with you. Like, just a really interesting creative publisher that were just firing on all cylinders in the arcade.
I remember, I'm fairly sure there were some like little Easter eggs you could trigger in by doing certain actions. Like, you could change the games up a bit or play different versions of the games as well.
Oh, okay.
But don't quote me on that. I remember reading that on, I think, Gaming Hell, which is that amazing website.
Yes, God, I haven't thought about Gaming Hell in a long time.
Yeah, well, it's still going.
It's still going,
my friend. I don't want to get their name or pronouns wrong, but the owner of that was on Retronauts quite recently, and I had to miss it, and I was quite disappointed. I wish I could have been on there with them.
Oh, amazing.
But yeah, check it out. Still going.
Cool stuff. One other thing I'd like to highlight with Volume 4 and 5 in particular is they've got these really cool, like, in the museum, you can explore this sort of, like, video gallery. And they have these bizarre little extras, like, so there's a Genpei Tomoden short film in that video gallery, which is basically just a samurai movie, and it's got all the campy silliness of like a live action, you know, samurai film. And I don't know what it was made for. You can watch the entire thing on YouTube with English subtitles if you're curious. But yeah, it's enormous. Like, it's a whole short film. It's crazy. And there's a similar thing for Barajuke on Volume 5. There's a little, like, you know, just animation essentially, which kind of gives you like the backstory of the game. Just fun little extras like that. Those are the things that like really elevate a retro compilation for me.
Yeah, agreed.
It's just like, go in on presentation and extras and just make it feel like an actual love letter to those games. Like, it highlight as much stuff as possible. Even just the little rooms for each individual game in the museum you can look at the system board and all the flyers and stuff and all the animations for the characters in the games and stuff. Just an insane level of detail. Yeah, really, really good.
But they also had, I'm not sure if it was in the first one, but the later ones, if you didn't want to ask around, you could just pull up a menu by pressing select, I think.
Yeah, you can do that in the later ones. I think you can do it in the early ones as well. But, but the museums in the earlier ones are a little bit more simplistic in comparison to the later ones, which have, you know, a lot more to look at and do and involve yourself with. There is even little Easter eggs within the rooms and stuff that you can trigger certain animations with characters and things. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of
when I mentioned earlier about affecting the games. Might be worth looking into, because I could have sworn there was stuff like you could get alternate like variants of the games and stuff by doing certain things.
I might have to have a little look up bollocks. I mean, it's the sort of thing that I wouldn't put it past them to hide in there, because it's just, it's so...
Weren't they also hosted by that robot that's still in... That, like, the receptionist of Namco or something. I can never remember what they're called.
Oh, the lanky robot. I don't know if... I've never seen them appear in anything else, but, like...
Maybe I'm mistaken.
But if it is a reference, then that's cool. I want to see what that shows up in again.
look up Namco receptionist robot, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's kind of great. It's like they have it sitting at, like, a desk when you go in the Namco headquarters and stuff.
You have to sign in with your name, and then, like, that becomes your save file, essentially. And
not that I've ever been to Namco headquarters.
I have.
If I do something,
It looks like a big Toblerone.
Perfect. If we're good with Namco Museum, I also want to mention that the five volumes, the covers spell out Namco, N-A-M-C-O.
Of course, which is basically the first thing anybody does when they get to the whole set, you know, like, lay it out. Yep. It says Namco. I can read that.
Because the PS3 doesn't let you choose the order that your things go in, it's just what you download them, you cannot change it.
Yeah.
I downloaded them backwards so that it would spell Namco properly. And I think I actually got it wrong, and I had to do it over because I got Namco Encore at the beginning instead of the end.
That's an insane level of dedication that I am fully.
Well, it's important to me.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, again, they're all available on the US PSN if you get on there. Definitely. I believe. And the Encore ones are available on the Japan PSN. So again, none of them are available on the Europe one, which doesn't affect most of our listeners. It does affect me. So, also on PS1 from a different major Japanese publisher, we've got Capcom Generations, which were released as individual discs over in Japan. But in Europe, we got a 4-disc box set, which contained... I'm just going to list these because it's not that long.
Yeah.
Disc 1 was Wings of Destiny. It was 1942, 1943, and 1943 Kai, which to my mind, and I'm not dissing these games, is probably the least interesting one because they're all basically the same. Disc 2 was called Chronicles of Arthur, and that was Ghosts and Goblins, Ghouls and Ghosts, and Super Ghouls and Ghosts, very oddly having a SNES game thrown in there.
Yeah.
Because that was not... I assumed it was the arcade version or something, but no, it's not. It's the SNES game. There is no real arcade version. I think it may have ended up in a few cabinets, but it's not an actual arcade game.
Okay,
The third one was the first generation, which had Volgus, Sonson, Pirate Ship Higamaru, and XZXs, which are... essentially, a very vintage Capcom games. And the final one, Blazing Guns, has Commando, Mercs, and Gunsmoke. Now, these are all games that would eventually be bundled together in other compilations, but my word, that Ghosts and Goblins disc, that Volgus, Sunson, Pirate Ship, Higamaru disc, and Blazing Guns, man, that's a good collection right there.
There's a lot of, you know, prime era Capcom arcade stuff in here.
There was unlockables that were so difficult to get that I did not manage to get them, I believe.
Interesting.
Little features. I remember Sonson, one of them was to get a certain number of the bamboo shoots that spring up at random.
Okay.
They're not at random, sorry. They're placed in certain places, but when you walk over the ground, they'll spring out.
Yeah.
And they're quite hard to get because Sonson is really position-based. It's all about positioning. If you haven't played Sonson, it's one of my favorite arcade games, and I only discovered it through this compilation.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even know what it was. And I was like, oh my God, this game from like the early 80s is actually amazing. I have a great time with Sonson.
I didn't know that this like compilation existed in PAL territory. I knew the individual volumes, you know, existed in Japan and stuff. Because one of my favorite viewing habits is a virtual gaming library, which is basically a YouTube channel dedicated to chronologizing an entire system's catalog of games. I remember seeing them show up in that, like in the Saturn, on the Saturn and PS1 ones. I didn't realize that there was a full 4-disc compilation that we got in PAL territories, which is probably stupidly expensive now, so I will never own it.
When I bought it from Game, I believe it was a tenner.
Wow. Okay.
I don't think that it has actually attained the value that some of the other ones have because the games are so freely available.
Yeah, yeah.
But I could be wrong about. I mean, they're about to be on the friggin' Evercade XP, so.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, they're on everything, but it was a nice compilation to have, especially introducing me to like Higamaru Sonson and like Mercs, which I love. I love Mercs. It's such a good game.
I only ever played the Mega Drive port myself, but I'll have to have a little go at the arcade version.
I think I have that, but I'm much more familiar with the arcade version.
Okay.
So I'll have to go back to it sometime.
Need to give that some time.
And that wasn't it for arcade games on the PS1, because there's another one called Arcade Party Pack, which I remember seeing around, but never actually playing.
So this was one of the first arcade compilations I ever owned, actually. This is a sort of a Midway and Atari games-focused collection. From 99, and also developed by Digital Eclipse. So 720, Smash TV, Clax, Rampage, Super Sprint, and Tubin. First time playing any of these games and basically fell in love with them. There's a lovely little extras menu where they actually interview all the developers and just, you know, they talk about their time developing the games and what their goals were.
I remember those. I think they reused the same interviews for Midway Arcade.
That would make sense.
With the same condition, like video.
Oh, they're horrendous, the quality of them. And even, what's even worse is that the PAL version of Arcade Party Pack, because it's obviously running at 50 hertz, the audio starts to lose sync with the video as the longer you watch it. So, kind of spoiled a little bit, unfortunately, being in the PAL territory, but still great games. I mean, like, Smash TV is a huge highlight for me, and Super Sprint in particular, I love. I have an obsession with locked screen racing games where you can see the entire circuit in one thing without having to scroll around. And Super Sprint is basically the pinnacle of that. Yeah, great game. Feels awesome when you slide around corners and stuff. Like,
I contend that Super Off-Road may be the pinnacle of that.
Fair enough. I mean, look, it's a great game. I'm not gonna knock it, but I just love the way the cars move around the corners in Super Sprint. You just let go.
Maybe there should be an episode in the future about single screen.
Yeah, that would be fun. That'd be fun. I do have a huge thread I created on Twitter of everyone I could discover.
Every time it pops up, I'm just like happy to see it.
It's just
there it is.
It's a lovely aesthetic, just seeing the entire circuit in one hit. So, yeah.
For me, the pick of this collection, other than Smash TV, I mean, it's Klax, baby.
Klax is a great puzzler. I know it gets a lot of flack for being quite simple, but it's just a nice time. And
It is the 90s, and it is time for Klax.
Absolutely. And I just like the sound of the weird tiles as they click down the thing. You know, it's a good time.
Yeah. Now, this, I want to say, was several compilations in the US, like, other than Arcade Party Pack, there was like Midway Arcade and there was Atari Arcade as well. So somehow
we didn't get those, I don't think.
They've come together here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's obviously, you know, that must have been our equivalent essentially, but
I mean, ignoring some other collections, like, there is Atari Anniversary and Atari Redux and stuff, which we're not going to cover.
There's so much on the PS1. Like, it's very much the first boom for retro compilations, totally.
As we mentioned, this is only a kind of loose thing. I mean, it's going to be longer than I expected. I think this might actually become a two-parter at this rate.
Oh god.
But Sonic Mega Collection 2002. Yes. I mean, got to talk about Sonic Mega Collection because in theory it's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, the games you're getting here, all of the mainline games, plus 3D Plus, plus Spinball, Mean Bean Machine, etc. and so forth.
Yep.
Flicky Wrist Star, I don't know if it's Ristar, I always call him Ristar.
It's Ristar. If you've ever looked at the Japanese phonetics for the name. It's Ristutar.
Ristar, okay.
And I think it is supposed to be a pun on his wrists, essentially, like, because he's got stretchy, wristy arms, you know? Like,
yeah, because he's a bit of a wrister, that's why. Get it? I slammed Ristar. This compilation is the reason I spent so many years not liking Ristar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because playing that thing with a GameCube controller is like tearing your own teeth out, as far as I'm concerned.
That's true.
You can't do diagonals, and the whole game is about doing diagonals.
Yeah, definitely.
But then when I played that game on a Mega Drive Mini, I was like,
I see, it's the
Mega Drive pad is supposed to be comfortable. What an unusual thing.
Yeah.
Now, what kills this compilation for me, and everyone probably knows this already, is the fact that it locks games behind unlockable conditions that are just stupid.
It's the worst. Yeah.
If it was, honestly, I could tolerate it if it was like, finish Sonic 1, 2, and 3 and you'll unlock Sonic and Knuckles. I would be like, that would be stupid, but I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's like, play Sonic the Hedgehog 50 or 30 times, I forget how many.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
And you'll unlock another game. Play all the games 30 times, you'll unlock, say, Ristar.
So you basically just sit on a menu going in and out of the game very quickly, because each time you enter the game,
every time you do that, it does the whole write into the game log thing.
Yeah. It always saves afterwards. It's just tedious. Like, but it's the only way to get, you know, Sonic 3 and Knuckles, essentially, which is like the best way to play Sonic 3 and Sonic Knuckles.
Like, exactly.
It's bonkers. Like, just that is the way you have to achieve that.
All it guarantees is that you will at some point spend an hour and a half doing that, just opening and closing games until the game log disappears, basically.
One of my GameCube memory cards wiped itself recently, and I had to do it all again, and it was just like, God, I do not miss having to do this again for the umpteenth time.
I got my friend Leanne to just come round with her memory card.
Yeah, just copy a save. That's the way you want. That's the way to do it. Yep.
Yeah, I did the same thing with someone. I remember someone at college. I gave them my memory card, and they came back the next day with like 180 emblem clear saves of Sonic Adventure 2 and stuff.
Yeah, I did the exact same thing with a friend. Yeah,
I want to play a Green Hill Zone 3D. I don't want to do all that crap and play that rubbish game.
Yep, good shout.
But yeah, other than Mega Collection, there's also Mega Collection Plus, which came out on PS2, Xbox, and PC in the next couple of years. Offers most of the same things, except also you get some Game Gear games thrown in there.
Yep.
The Game Gear games that weren't included as extras in Sonic Adventure DX Director's Cut.
Yeah.
Which is just like absolute scenes. I mean, it's nice of them to get them out there.
Yeah.
But.
But it's just like, just put them all on there, you know. It's just a strange thing, because they do eventually show up, the rest of them, on Sonic Gems Collection. But yeah, it's a bit of a strange thing to just get them all on there. What's the point?
You can get the Ooze and Comics Zone for some reason, I guess because they were also developed by Sega Technical Institute.
Yeah, I think that's the only connection.
I believe there was also Vector Man on there, 1 and 2.
Yes.
Which you unlocked by having a save of Sonic Heroes or something?
Something like that, yeah.
So it's like insult to injury, isn't it? Like, not only have you wasted your time playing Sonic Heroes, you now have to play...
yourself as a Sonic Heroes player, yeah.
Actually, I quite like Vector Man, I have to be honest. I do quite like Vector Man.
I don't mind Vector Man 1, but Vector Man 2 is way too dark to play.
Vector Man 2 is like... Yeah, the same thing, except you can't see anything coming because it's dark all the time. But it's okay-ish. I mean, these are fine compilations, providing you can get them unlocked. There are some sound issues, but for God, only real like turbo nerds are going to notice them.
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then we get the weird collection, Sonic Gems.
Oh, I loved this thing. Oh, but this is the one that Vector Man's on. I'm talking complete crap.
Yeah. Sonic Gems has got Vector Man 1 and 2 on it.
Sorry, I messed up. It's not on the PS2 one.
It's all good. But yeah, this is... I've probably played this one the most, despite the fact that it really isn't the best collection.
I mean, I unlocked the entire like museum in this, which is an absurd undertaking. But that was the years when I had time.
Well, didn't we all? Yeah. But yeah,
the real. I mean, what this has is, because at the time these were games that were not only like kind of scarce, but they were mostly. Correct me if I'm wrong, mostly not emulated. So this is the only way you were going to play them unless you have a copy of Sonic R. I mean, Sonic the Fighters hadn't been ported in any respect.
So that is a brand new port for this version. And Sonic CD and Sonic R are the PC versions, in fact, ported over to the next version. I actually did import the Japanese version of this because I wanted the Sonic CD soundtrack that I know. And not the American one. No offense, Spencer Nielsen.
The PAL version of this had the American soundtrack, didn't it?
It did, which is a real strange choice.
I don't hate that soundtrack, but it's not got 2-2 Sonic Warrior, so
but this
what's the point of it?
This is what I was saying before, you know, where you get the lazier collections where it's just like, right, okay, every Western region gets the same thing instead of it being localized for the specific regions, which is a real shame. But the Japanese version is a banger because it also adds the Streets of Rage trilogy and Bonanza Brothers as extras as well.
Yeah, bare knuckle.
Yeah, damn right. Really good
stuff.
Are
they unlocked from the beginning?
I cannot remember if you have to unlock them or not, but to be honest with you, however the way you got them, I was happy to unlock it because it's just
You also get Bonanza Brothers, which is a banger.
Yeah, it is. It's a real good game. Yeah. Real good game. And yeah, obviously we get the remaining Game Gear games on this collection as well. So you get Sonic 2,
so you get to play secret hidden best Sonic game, Tails Adventures.
I mean, it's a banger, isn't it?
It's a great game. The only bad thing about it is you have to play as Tails, who's a twat.
Controversial opinion there.
Oh, he's just such a loser. I hate Tails, man. He's like, oh, can I come with you? And just like banging into bombs and losing all your rings and just, and then they'd like, oh, let's make him, into an inventor, because that's not annoying. So now you've got Jimmy Neutron following you around all the time going, according to my calculations, shut up. I'm sorry, I got in a bit of a rant there.
It's all good. Sonic
shouldn't hang out with Tails. Sonic's cool and Tails is lame. Sonic should bully Tails. That's how it should be going.
Yeah, he inevitably becomes cool because he hangs around with a cool person, right? That's how it works.
He's just chasing after Sonic's fame, isn't he? We can talk about how much I hate Tales and that I hate Tales dedicated podcast.
but we've got compilations
to cover, my friend.
Let's do it. Let's do some Midway.
Yeah, Midway. Let's get through these because these are vast. There's three of them. Midway Arcade Treasures 1, 2, and 3.
Yep.
What a set, though.
Oh my god! Like, it's worth having all of them because you just get an absolute like history lesson on Midway here. It's awesome. Yeah. The only one I'd say that's probably not worth your time is maybe 3, because as much as there's some good games in there, they are not the best versions of those games. They run like crap on PS2. I can't speak for the Xbox version because I've never played it, but you know, San Francisco Rush, Hydro Thunder, and like Off-Road Thunder and things like that, they're all proper 3D arcade games, and they just, the frame rate is abysmal on PS2. I hate to complain about that, but Hydro Thunder is not too bad, but again, it's not the best way to play that game. But yeah, the first two collections are just a potted history of like the absolute best stuff.
I can't remember Stunrunner or not even running that well.
Yeah, which is strange, right? Because it's very simplistic polygonal game. But
yeah, but it's also, I think it's its only home port.
Yeah, because the only other one is on the bloody Lynx, isn't it? So yeah.
It's a shame because Stunrunner's really cool.
Yeah, no, it is a shame. Again, I can't speak for the Xbox version. Maybe they run a little bit better on there, but PS2 version is not so hot.
But the original two, we're talking. The first one repeats a lot of the stuff that was on, if not all the stuff that was on Arcade Party Pack, but also adds a load of stuff like Root Beer Tapper and like odd stuff like Satan's Hollow.
Yeah.
And Bubbles, which is awesome. I think that was the one that was like unreleased. Am I wrong about that?
I'm not too sure regarding Bubbles. But yeah, it's a cool game. Very weird little game. But yeah, very good fun.
And there's also Marble Madness, which is an absolute all-timer.
Of course. And Robotron, which you can play with twin sticks finally for the first time.
Yeah.
I love the presentation of Midway Arcade Treasures, where it's like this weird pyramid, essentially. Yeah, they're exploring and it's all the little treasures in there. Each game is kind of like represented by a symbol instead of its name, which is confusing as all hell, but I kind of like the presentation overall is just kind of fun and silly, you know. It's just a real good time.
They
dump that for 2 and 3.
They just move straight to sort of a unified menu system, don't they?
Yeah, which is a bit of a shame.
They make up for it with the games they include, though.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But then there's a real strange thing in that Midway Arcade Treasures 2 includes Mortal Kombat 2 and 3, which are probably the ones you want to play more than the original. But why not have the original on there, right?
It's really weird.
Yeah, but it is on the extended play version of PSP. On PSP, you can get all three Mortal Kombats on a handheld on the PSP version.
That's really weird.
Yeah, odd as all hell. That's a nice little collection as well.
I thought it was because it was included with like Mortal Kombat Deception or something. I might be wrong about that.
It might be a case of like, you know, it was out at a similar time as another game that had
it on. There was some weirdness going on with Mortal Kombat around this time.
I think Shaolin Monks might have the original Mortal Kombat on as an unlockable.
I think that might be two actually again.
Yeah.
But I might be wrong. I've been playing Shaolin Monks lately because it runs really well on the Steam Deck.
Oh, lovely. Lovely stuff.
But yeah, I've been wanting to guess a bit of a white whale for me, so I used to play it with my mate and I really want to finish it.
Oh, definitely. But I haven't finished it myself, good game, totally.
Yeah. But other than the Mortal Kombats, you've got like Narc, which I love. You've got APB. You've got Total Carnage, which is like the even more mental sequel to Smash TV.
Yeah.
You've got Primal Rage, which is an absolute cult hit.
Yep, totally. Rampage World Tour, mate.
One of my favourites, Rampage World Tour, on the PS1, I used to absolutely live for that game.
Oh, what a game, man. What a game. Yeah.
I got fond memories of hanging out with my best friend at the time, playing that on PS1, randomly mashing buttons during the loading screens and triggering a secret code, which made us all go absolutely crazy.
Amazing. What a find.
Yeah. Yeah, and then every time we got a loading screen from then on, I would just start tapping random buttons, and I hope it would lock stuff, and sometimes it did.
Yeah.
What a game.
Oh, yeah, no, amazing game. Just loads of great stuff on here, man. Like, well worth owning all three of these.
Xenophobe, a game about being racist.
Don't think that's quite what they were going for there, but yeah.
Yeah. You can just be incidentally racist while playing the game, but I prefer that you weren't.
I'm glad. Yeah. Just awesome collections. And like I say, that PSP version is also worth owning. It's essentially, if you want some Mortal Kombat on the go, well worth
very, very good versions. Yeah,
definitely.
The I'm sure there's reasons why Mortal Kombat purists don't like it, but I don't really know what they are.
Oh, I mean, this is one of those things, isn't it? Like, with retro compilations, people do get, like, hung up on the quality of the emulation and input lag and things like that. And at the end of the day, that's fine, but these are not really, these compilations aren't really made for people like that are looking for the absolute best way to play a certain game. This is just a way to get a potted history of, you know, a publisher or a system and play it at a level that is decent enough to enjoy. And these are all solid enough ways to play these games. Like,
that's something that I can't say about something on Next in Line, though, I have to say. Because if we're moving on, we're still on PS2.
Yeah.
Which
is basically the era of the emulated port now. We're there now. We're stopping doing straight ports. It's all under emulation now.
Well, Taito decided in their wisdom, and I mean that sincerely, to release three if you count Power Up on the PSP, but I don't. Yeah. Two Taito Legends compilations, which were based on Taito Memories, the Japanese set. Now, 2005 and 2006. And the first one is loaded up with, I want to say, 30-odd games.
Yeah.
And they play fine. Like, you've got stuff like Space Gun, which is a light gun game, so that doesn't really...
You don't have any light gun support, unfortunately, for any of the light gun games
But there are so many great games, like Rainbow Islands, Rastan...
Yep.
You know, New Zealand Story, Operation Wolf, like another, you know, both up Wolf.
I'm a big fan of Continental Circus, which is a really cool racing game. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, just really, and you know, the usual bubble. And the menus aren't super great, but the games all run fine. They're all basically playable. But then Taito Legends 2 comes along with its, I want to say, 50-odd games.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? This is an absolute insane collection.
They mix them up with, like, some of them are PS2 exclusive, some of them are Xbox exclusive.
Yeah.
I've got to say the Xbox got the better deal here by getting both Bubble Symphony and Kadash and Rayforce.
I would argue against this.
Might have got G-Darius.
This is it. I would argue against it because I am such a G-Darius mark. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I love that game. It's probably the best shmup ever made, as far as I'm concerned.
G-Darius.
Yeah, I adore it, man. I mean,
it's not as good as the game that it's an anagram of, but, like, you know, I kid. G-Darius is great. The main problem I have with it is I haven't learned all the mechanics yet, so I know how to do, like, beam fight and stuff. And if I knew how to do it, I'd be able to actually...
Basically, it's as simple as when you turn your captured ships into a laser, if you fire that laser into a pink laser from an enemy, you will get into a duel, essentially. But you will always win because your laser absorbs theirs and it becomes enormous as a result. It's just silly as all hell, but I love it.
I just love the aesthetics of G-Darius. And the weirdest thing is G-Darius was a standalone PS1 game, and that's not that long ago.
Absolutely,
I've got to reel off some games on this thing because this is one of my favorite retro collections, despite being massively flawed.
It's incredible.
I mean, Bubble Symphony is incredible. Mm. Both Darius games. Liquid Kids. I love Liquid Kids.
Liquid Kids is wicked.
And Puzzle Bobble 2, the best one.
Yep.
One of my all time favorite, absolute peak arcade games, only in this, is Space Invaders 95.
I
love that game. And it's only in this, and every single time, like, Hamster announcing a new arcade archives, I'm like, come on, Super Space Invaders 95, come on. Attack of the Looney Loonies, let's go.
And it never happens.
But the issue with this is there's so much on here that I haven't even mentioned Elevator Action Returns being on here.
Oh, yeah. Camel Tree, man. I love Camel Tree. What a game.
Camel Tree, also known as On the Ball. There are some games on here, and I want to say Metal Black is one of them.
Yeah, Metal Black has an
where
issue.
They just don't work properly.
Yeah.
There's one game where you can't use bombs. Like, you're not able to use them. They didn't map it to anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, how does this happen?
I
will take a flawed compilation like this just to get... when I couldn't get these games any other way back then.
Of course.
I can buy Liquid Kids on Switch. I can emulate Liquid Kids now. But back then, that was not an option.
Yeah.
Like, not for me. So this is huge. But to put out a retro compilation where some of the games just don't work is kind of messed up.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I can forgive it because, I mean, it was a budget release at the time. I probably spent no more than £5 on it. And, you know, it just gives you an enormous quantity of absolute bangers. So it's difficult to get, like, hung up on things like, oh, you know, Metal Black doesn't quite work correctly or whatever.
Yeah.
Agreed. So, yeah, I... it's not the best to release a game like that. It is definitely not in its favor, but at the same time, there's so much good stuff on here that it's just like, yeah, I'll take the hit. Why the hell not? If I can play this many good games. And I love the fact that it's one of the few games that introduces basically like a favorites list. So you can essentially filter out what games you like to play the most and have them on its own dedicated list. A few retro compilations will do that down the line that we're going to look at. But no, it's a really nice little feature that just, cut the wheat from the chaff essentially and make your own list.
So 2002 brought us what is quite a hard sell to a lot of people even now in retro gaming, which is Atari VCS / 2600 games. And Activision Anthology has about 50 of them.
Yeah.
This thing probably changed the way that I think about retro gaming, because I was a retro gamer even back in this era playing these compilations. Because everyone on Retronauts knows now, I was pretty much raised by emulation because they didn't have anything else. But Activision Anthology was my first real exposure to Atari 2600 games. Now, it wasn't my first exposure to these games, because one day my uncle brought home from some market this device called the TV Boy.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Infamous.
Which I now know contained lots of hooky, recolored, renamed Atari VCS games.
Yeah.
So the game known as Pitfall, one of the most famous Atari games ever, to me was known as Forest Walk.
Okay. Well, you know, nice and on the nose, that one, isn't it? So, yeah.
Yeah, though I think, even now that I say that, given that I had Pitfall, the Mayan Adventure, I must have known it was Pitfall. So that's rewritten all my entire history just there. Everything's been thrown into disarray. So I must have been aware that these were of a similar vintage to Pitfall.
I guess so, yeah.
But Activision's... the thing is, with the VCS, lovely machine. You're very fond of the Atari 2600, aren't
you? Yeah, absolutely. A big fondness for it. But yeah, as most people know, the games are very simplistic. You know, they're very much arcade ports a lot of the time. So they have that sort of a quarter munching quality to them, where it's just like one more go. We'll have another go. But like, yeah, the actual game itself is very limited in what you can do. A good VCS game will always have like a nice addictive quality to it, where it's just like, I like that gameplay loop. I will continue to play this. And like, no developer and publisher was doing that better than Activision, basically, at the time.
Activision, to me, it kind of is the VCS. Yeah, like, totally. When I want to play a VCS game, mostly, until recently, because of a certain project that we'll talk about.
Yeah.
I was pretty much on these games, because games like Chopper Command holds up great. Frostbite, I would play now. I love Frostbite.
I still play Hero and Keystone Capers. Yeah. Like,
I love Keystone Capers.
Great games. Just a really solid hook, you know, that you just want to keep doing, because it's such a nice time.
I love Mega Mania. I love Pluck Attack. I love River Raid. River Raid is a banger.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Enduro as well. Really good little racing game. Yeah,
there's so many cool games on this thing. Now, the thing that makes it even cooler is back in the day, Activision would offer someone patches for your clothes or whatever.
Yeah.
If you were to send in like proof of certain high score thresholds.
Yeah.
So this was literally, the early version of achievements was mailing a photograph
of your television
to Activision themselves, which they will then reply. And in a brilliant touch, just such a great touch, you can unlock those patches in this game by playing
to the level that you would have had to play.
But also, in reaching certain scores, you'll unlock things like old Atari commercials, which incidentally are insane brilliant.
Yeah, no, they're incredible.
The one for Mega Mania is just like permanently stuck in my head.
Oh, with the band, so good.
It's so good. And that game is good too, Mega Mania. Yeah, no, totally. It's fun.
No, it's an insanely cool collection. And like, if anything, it's one of the first times where we sort of see some sort of like digital archiving happening here instead of just a straight up retro compilation.
Yeah.
You know, the presentation is very much like, no, we want to do these games service. We want to present them in a way that really puts them in their absolute highlight. So you've got this lovely bedroom aesthetic, don't you?
Yeah. And they had to give it the context with like the 80s music that you can listen to.
That's the other thing that's cracking about it is you get like a selection of actual licensed 80s like pop hits.
Yeah.
And that play on the radio in the bedroom, and it's just like, oh, what a lovely thing.
You've got like Twisted Sister, you've got like Soft Cell and stuff. Yeah. It's really good stuff.
You can even
like,
continue to play the games whilst the licensed songs play in the background. It's just wicked stuff, man. It's piece of work.
One of my favorite silly features is the fact that one of the filters makes it look like you've been smoking.
Yeah.
So you've got the smoke drifting over the screen, because that's probably what you would have.
Yeah.
Like, the game's all laid out on that ridiculous rotating rack as well. It's great fun.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, if that thing exists, I want one. God, man.
Yes, it's really great. And the compilations were not even, like, done with the Mega Drive. Like, because Sega had once again gone, okay, we've got Sonic out there, now we need to get some other stuff on the go.
Yeah, so we get the Mega Drive collection from 2006, right?
Yeah, this was Backbone, I want to say.
Yes, it was.
Criticized, but in my opinion, this was a fine collection. Honestly.
I think it's a great collection. In fact,
I was happy with this.
It's one of the, why I'd like to highlight the PS2 one in particular is because there's a little bit more of an element of, they actually bothered to localize it correctly for the different regions. So this is a Mega Drive collection. It says Mega Drive. It's not Genesis games.
Yes.
I really appreciate that sort of thing. But some of the stuff included on these is ridiculous. I mean, the PSP one in particular.
That's the best one.
Gives you a bloody Congo Bongo as an unlockable.
Oh, bit of Congo Bongo.
I love that stuff, man. But yeah, each version, the PS2 and PSP have different unlockable games. So it's almost worth having both, because there's some cool stuff in there.
And the conditions are easier.
Yes, like,
they're not ridiculous.
Yeah. A lot of the time it's just open one of the games and it will unlock something.
Yeah. I think there's like Get a Chaos Emerald is one of them. Like, it's Sonic the Hedgehog, Get a Chaos Emerald.
Absolutely. And that's completely doable. But yeah, you get the Phantasy Star 2, 3, and 4 on the compilation for the first time. You get Golden Axe, the entire trilogy. You get the absolute best Mega Drive game of all time, Game Ground.
Yeah, Game Ground, mate. Finally getting some Game Ground on Retronauts.
Damn right.
It's about time. There's not been a single good episode until now.
Here we are. We've arrived at
Game Ground. Yes, mate.
Damn right.
I swore. Oh, well.
It's all good.
I don't even care. Game Ground, baby.
Let's do it. But yeah, Shadow Dancer, Shinobi 3, really good stuff on this.
Oh, like, I call it GG. That's my shorthand
for Game Ground.
Yeah, sorry, do go on.
But yeah, just really great collections.
You say Shadow Dancer, but that was not on my version. I'm pretty sure that was US version only for some reason.
Maybe it was. Maybe there was a censorship issue there or something.
The PSP version of that definitely didn't have Shadow Dancer, which is really unusual.
Mm. But no,
which
honestly,
is a shame, because it's genuinely a great game.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, like, yeah, it's a really good compilation, a lovely way to get a load of Mega Drive games at once, and also some really weird curios in the extras, and some lovely interviews with developers.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it goes above and beyond just to give you extras and additional like content and things that are outside of the video games that just help elevate the whole package. It's a real nice time.
It's a strong one. The only downers I would give it, other than what I've already mentioned, is they've got that crappy Mega Drive version of Virtua Fighter on there.
Yeah, they keep rolling that one out, don't they? It's a bit of a strange
I'm always amazed that they bother.
Yeah. But yeah, we should probably talk about the Ultimate Collection though, because a lot of what that collection draws from is the PS2 version.
Man, you know how you can buy all of these Sega games separately on Steam?
Yeah.
Right. I'd like to see the sales figures for that Virtua Fighter 2 port. Like, I'd like to see the sales, and I'd like to see the refunds. Because there is no way, I cannot imagine that anyone would be like, I mean, there's got to be a few people who grew up with it.
I guess
somehow
so.
they made the wrong choices and grew up with it. I don't know. Anyway, sorry. Yes, Mega Drive Ultimate Collection. This was a PS3 and 360, I believe.
Yeah, so this is basically an enhanced version of the PS2 game with a bigger list of games. You also get more unlockable games. One of the unlockable games is the original Phantasy Star, which basically gives you the entire franchise on one disc, which is awesome. You also get, you know, the arcade version of Shinobi. You get Golden Axe Warrior, which is a banger of a Master System game.
It's really good, yeah.
You get all the Sonics, although for some reason you can't combine Sonic 3 and Knuckles, which is a real
daft. I remember this because Backbone said it wasn't possible to do it, and then someone did it, and it's like changing two bytes or something.
It's, yeah, daft. That's all hell.
Don't say it's not possible to the Sonic fan base, because they will find a way,
absolutely. And of course, you're
getting like all Shining Force and the Phantasy Star games up to that point, including the Master System one, as we mentioned. And they've included Game Ground again. So,
exactly, very important. Game Ground's there again. Good stuff. Yeah, we recognize it.
One of my favorite games, eSWAT.
Yep. No, it's a really good collection. Beyond Oasis is an absolute like rarity as well. That's lovely to have that in there as well. It's a great version, but once again falls foul of the localization issue. Yes, the title screen says Mega Drive Ultimate Collection, but all the artwork and all the references in the bonus menus and stuff is to Genesis instead of Mega Drive. It's just a bit of a shame that the overall package wasn't localized correctly for the region. But again, you can't really complain when you're getting this much content, I guess. And
these won't be too expensive either.
No, not at all.
The current Mega Drive collection, I think, the one on the Switch. I think it's brilliant, but it doesn't have all of this. Like, there is pretty sure there's stuff missing.
Yeah, I mean, the current collection only has Mega Drive games on it, so no extra arcade stuff or Master System games.
Yeah, none of those arcade games.
The thing I really don't like about it is that it has frameskip issues, which is something that really shouldn't be happening on a modern system. Even if you play it on PS5, it still has frameskip issues, which is not
really
hot.
Really?
But that version does also crib the bedroom aesthetic that Activision Anthology did. So, you know, Sega obviously.
So, on the one hand, it's got some issues, but on the other hand, it's got Alien Soldier.
True. There we go. True. Yeah, again, you have to, you know, fight your battles sometimes.
Has it got Game Ground, though? That's my question.
Oh, it must do. It must do now. It's important that it's there.
Now we started with Sega, and I want to kind of finish with it, if that's okay with
you.
Because the Sega Ages 2500 series is a thing. And it started out as one thing and ended up being something very different, which is interesting. Like, Sega took stock of it and they kind of went, nah, this isn't working. Let's change it up. So, like,
initially,
the earlier ones were
3D remakes, weren't they?
Essentially 3D remakes of games like Outrun, Golden Axe, and Alien Syndrome. Now, some of them were good, Alien Syndrome.
Yep.
Others not so good.
Yeah.
Golden Axe.
Golden Axe is atrocious. Yeah, God.
Version of Bonanza Brothers was pretty good, I have to add.
Definitely. That one's very much just an upscaling of the original visuals, so it doesn't lose too much. We got a little compilation of these in the West.
Sega Classics Collection.
Which is an interesting little collection. I have a lot of time for it. I think there's some good stuff in here.
I dig it. I like weird stuff.
So absolutely. This is the thing. I still think it has probably one of the best virtual racing ports of all time on it.
Until the Switch one came out, it was pretty much the one, wasn't it?
This one still has more content than the Switch version. There's more tracks on it and stuff. It's a good time. It's a real good time to work. It's well worth checking out.
I mean, I just think that getting what were individually released in Japan as like 10 separate games on one disc is a pretty good value proposition.
Absolutely,
in
a
general.
Real bargain. And, it's a real shame that we didn't get Alien Syndrome in PAL territory, unfortunately.
That really sucks because it's probably the best one.
Yeah.
Like, Alien Syndrome, that version, Sega Ages 2500, already in 14.
Yeah.
Alien Syndrome, if you find a way to play it, I'm pretty sure it's not on the Japanese PSN, so, you know, buy a copy or emulate it and delete it within 24 hours.
Exactly.
It's pretty much just, like, kind of Contra.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
It's got massive Contra vibes. It's really fun in a way that the later Wii game wasn't.
Oh, God, that Wii game is horrendous.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
This is much more fun. It's a lot more like the original arcade game,
yep.
Except even more streamlined. I really highly recommend it. In fact, Sega Classic Collection, even though it reviewed very badly, if you're a Sega fan, you kind of have to get it.
Yeah, like, no, I would recommend it. There's not too many stinkers, to be honest with you. Golden Axe is kind of really the outlier there. But like honestly, there's some really good stuff in here. The Monaco GP game is a lot of fun, really fast paced and twitchy. The Fantasy Zone port is really good fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a good time. Like I say, that Virtual Racing port I think is a real highlight as well. But obviously, yeah, the Sega Ages series kind of pivoted later on, didn't it? To be
it did. Yeah.
More after of that, a, I think yeah retro compilation theme.
Well,
thing
this is instead. Where the company M2 sort of came into sort of prominence.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
Because they were behind some of these things that back in the day. When these came out, these were a big deal, like Gunstar yep. Heroes Treasure Box, because at this time, Treasure were just like retro gaming, like Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, they were being the treated like stuff absolutely flawless. Yeah. Now, we've moved away from that now, I think,
yeah.
But it was like, oh my god, Dynamite Heady, Gunstar Heroes, Alien Soldier. And yeah, that's a great
That's a great package,
right there.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a real good time.
Alien Soldier is a curate's egg, I think they call it.
Okay.
It's a acquired taste.
Yeah, I still haven't clicked with it. One day it'll happen,
yeah.
But it's still not quite happening.
My Alien Soldier is basically use reflect a lot, like use the double tap to reflect constantly
yep.
to get more health so you can use the Phoenix Charge, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Failing that, enemies that throw bombs can have them reflected back at them. It's all about deflection.
Right,
basically.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's still really hard, even if you know that. But yeah. It's actually, even if you do know that, it's actually possible to get past the first few levels.
Well, there you go.
Because you cannot play it normally. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
But that collection was an early like showcase for M2, because it was like, okay, here's Alien Soldier, here's Dynamite Heady, here's Gunstar Heroes. But we've gone above and beyond, and we've included the Game Gear versions of these games.
So yes, that, absolutely.
You
know, if I remember correctly,
extra, like,
yeah, you can like change the type of system the sound driver's running
yes,
on.
You can,
yeah, which is kind of fun.
But the even more impressive was like the Fantasy Zone and Monster World sets that included like everything. I mean, the Fantasy Zone one is insane, the
yes,
amount of stuff
yeah.
it includes. It's
yeah.
like all the arcade versions, the Mark III version, a version remade based on the NES version.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't include the NES version.
Yeah, yeah.
They also made a new, because Fantasy Zone 2 was originally just a Master System Mark III game.
Yeah, yeah.
They remade it. They made,
yeah, they made a System 16
version.
Yeah, yeah. It's really cool.
Fantasy Stone 2 that fits like a glove. It's like it was always there.
Yeah, you can get that version on 3DS now as well.
You can, and it's awesome.
Well worth
yeah,
owning.
I think it's also somehow on the Switch, but I might be wrong on that.
Okay.
In fact, it is definitely on the Switch now that I think about it.
Mm.
It's
yeah.
part of their Sega Ages on the Switch, I believe.
Okay. But yeah, no, yeah. That is an incredibly extensive collection of Fantasy Zone games.
Yeah.
Like, well worth owning.
Like the Game Gear game, the Mega Drive game,
yeah,
and Galactic
yeah.
Protector for some reason.
Yeah, the little spin-offs that have Opa Opa
yeah.
in them. Yeah, no, it's really good fun.
Oh, and the maze, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah, the Pac-Man one, where Opa Opa's a Pac-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
But that, I mean, there are so many others. Like, so there's this Sega Memorial selection with even older games.
Yeah,
like,
very early
bringing
arcade
back
stuff.
The classic Congo Bongo, you know?
Yeah. Head On, which is infamously built into a lot of Sega arcade boards as like an extra.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's that pivot at the end of the life of the Sega Ages series is probably where you want to be if you want to explore some cool little compilations, because they're all M2 developed. So, they are the peak.
I want to say a lot of these are on the PSN for PS3.
Absolutely.
Like you can just go and get them, and I recommend you do.
Mm.
The Fantasy Star Complete Collection you'd think would be unplayable, but no, the English versions are on there.
Yeah.
They put them on there. There are other remakes
they knew what
of Fantasy
people were
Star which
do.
Aren't in English. But
yeah. They knew you were going to import it, so yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of brings us around. Like there are others, obviously. We've skipped Capcom Classics, Reloaded, and etc.
Yeah, I mean, there's some later, you know, like 360 stuff. There's obviously that Midway
yeah.
Arcade Origins collection. There's a nice little Capcom collection of XBLA stuff on 360 as well.
There's the Midway Arcade on Origins as well.
Yeah, yeah. That's sorry, I think I've got the title wrong when I was mentioning it before, but yeah, that's the one I meant.
Yeah, yeah, sorry, yeah, yeah. That's
yeah.
surprisingly good, in my opinion.
And even, you know, up until now, we're getting Atari Flashback collections on PS4 and stuff. They're very nice little collections, but
yeah,
they have...
they've all been blown out of the water.
Exactly, by Atari 50.
Yeah, the anniversary celebration.
Mm, God, what a compilation this is.
It's the best compilation that's ever been made.
Oh, It's close. It's definitely up there, right? Like,
yeah, it's up there at the top.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, I mean, for me personally, I think I prefer a more condensed collection because I actually like to spend time with games.
Yeah.
When I've got something like this, where it's just an enormous list of games, things fall by the wayside, unfortunately, and it doesn't get my time.
It's the best presentation.
Yeah,
ever,
the one criticism is basically that for me personally. There's just a little bit too much on here.
My one criticism is there's no Activision, but then how could there be?
Yeah, well, this is it. It's an Atari collection, right? But, oh my God, the presentation is incredible. The timeline is gorgeous. I love the idea of basically making a virtual museum. And, you know, you explore it like you would a museum display. And it's just incredible. The amount of stuff that's in here. Interviews, concept art, box art that you can actually view in 3D. Just quotes from developers and things.
Games as well. They've added
new, brand new games, which are actually like up there as like,
really good.
Just, you know, they work well alongside their games that they're sitting against.
Vector Sector is just so good.
Oh, what a great time. Just like fusing all the Vector stuff into one massive adventure. Yeah. Like, that's
and
so cool.
The new take on combat, which I forget the name of, is stunning.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, like, yeah, that's a game that needs a refresh, to be honest with you. But like, yeah, it's a great version of it. Like, honestly, why play combat when you play that now? There's some incredible stuff in here. There's bonus games as well in there that have some insane, that what you have to do to get them is a bit strange, but like,
we go over that a bit in the interview.
Good
portion,
stuff,
I believe.
Good stuff.
I spoke to Additional Clips and got Chris Connor and Mike Mika.
Lovely stuff.
Got some very enjoyable interview content, I think. So I'm going to rudely wind this down now.
Yeah. I think this is a good place to end it.
Okay, you've heard me and Lewis babbling on about compilations for a fair while now, so I think it's time for something more sort of informative at this point, and hopefully also interesting, because I'm talking to a couple of fine people from Digital Eclipse. Would you mind introducing yourselves, please? Probably in alphabetical order, I think.
By first name or last name. I guess it's me either way. Hi, I'm Chris Kohler. I'm editorial director at Digital Eclipse, and then also...
I'm Mike Mica, president of Digital Eclipse.
This is all very exciting. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm unashamedly kind of a Digital Eclipse fanboy now, because I've been very excited about what you're doing with compilations, because, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I feel like the first of the kind of contemporary Digital Eclipse compilations was the Mega Man Legacy Collection in terms
that's
of what
correct.
It was offering. Because that's what sort of established. I don't like to call it a template because it has kind of evolved from that, I think. But you had your games, you had your supplemental material, extremely high resolution scans of supplemental material. But incidentally, I bought on eBay Williams Arcade Classics for Mega Drive recently. And that was Digital Eclipse as well, apparently. So there is quite a long lineage coming along there. But I guess the first thing I want to ask is, with these compilations, we've got, say, Disney Classic Games Collection, Disney Afternoon Collection, the Samurai Showdown Neo Geo Collection, the Blizzard Arcade Collection. That's just to name four of them. But how do these sort of come together? Or is the first step like someone just thinks, oh, hey, that would be a cool thing to have? And then sort of pitches to whoever owns this stuff, or how does it work exactly?
It's a little bit of both. I'd say going back to the Mega Man collection, Legacy collection, that was kind of like a calling card for what we decided the company would push for and try to build, like you said, a template. We wanted to build something that was kind of like that calling card for these companies. So once that came out, we started to get a lot of calls from other companies who had IP or latent IP or been thinking about doing some sort of collections. Mm. And they were basically requesting, we want something like you did with Mega Man for our games. And we've also been going out and trying to do, look at what we call like our dream or bucket list of game collections and remasters and stuff that we want to do. And so simultaneously, while we're getting these calls coming in with some really interesting opportunities, you think of like SNK or Disney, those kind of things. we also have been going out and knocking on doors, trying to get our hands on the things that we think are really important, and that like, kind of come from a place of where, does it have a story in the history of games that we can tell, essentially? Because we treat these things kind of like a documentary.
Yeah, that was interesting about the bucket list, what you said, because I was going to mention that there are things that you've been bringing out, for example, the Cowabunga collection, that a lot of people would say, if you could sort of say, what's your dream game compilation? They'd say Turtles games, you know. It's the sort of thing that seemed so far beyond what was possible to have. And, you know, now it's out there. Same with the Disney Afternoon collection. It never thought it would happen. They were just like, those games were great. Everyone loves them. They're not getting re-released because they're licensed games, but, you know, ho-hum, here we are. it's happened. But I've got to ask now, with the sort of going from the sort of museum perspective and talking about sort of the extras here, because I feel like those in some ways are the main event when it comes to presenting these games, because, okay, I hate saying this because it sounds like I'm advocating, but you can play these games in other ways that, you know, I won't mention. So that what becomes important, I think, is contextualizing the games and presenting them with interesting extras to make people value them. And it's not just like, here's artwork, here's save, rewind, etc. All that stuff is welcome. But with Atari 50, it's actual context. It's, here is a game that you might play for 5 seconds, go, I'm not playing this ever again, you know, and move on. Now it's, I see how this was the stepping stone to this, you know, that's a fantastic approach. So for me, it feels a bit like a sort of culmination of what you've done before. Sorry, I'm talking way too much for what's supposed to be an interview.
Yes. And what's the question?
I'll go that's back
excellent,
a little bit.
No, I mean, excellent encapsulation of our feelings.
It really was.
100%, yeah.
Okay, I'll go back a bit, because the Disney Classic Games Collection, which came out, I want to say 2018, 19, that included something that blew my mind, which was Aladdin the Final Cut, because that doesn't happen. That was a Disney's Mega Drive Aladdin game, which many people consider the best one. So they might be misguided on that, but anyway, moving on. the Final Cut was a compilation. Actually, why don't you tell us what the Final Cut was and how that came about? Because that really is a fantastic thing to include in a compilation.
Yeah, I mean, that really, the first inkling of that was Frank Cifaldi and the Video Game History Foundation had found or had been given source code to Aladdin, and going through that source code, we discovered that there was much more in the game that was intended to be in there. It was stuff that was just turned off or just was almost finished. And so digging into that, we had our engineer, Rich Whitehouse, who's a genius, kind of go through and make sure that this thing could be compiled and could we reinstate some of these aspects of the game. And the final cut that we have out there, I would say, is the near final cut, because there was even more stuff that we would have liked to have put in, but there's like cultural sensitivities and other things that we have to be careful about that we weren't sure would be something that we should put out there or not or whatever, but because it's a different world than the 90s or whatever. But so with that in mind, there was this article that the Video Game History Foundation had put out about it, and Rich had written the article and talked about what was all in there. And that was like a light going off, because we're like, this should actually be kind of like the cornerstone to a project that we would do. This is the kind of stuff we want to put into projects. So we approached Disney with the idea and Nighthawk and said, this is what we want to do. And it was kind of funny, because it's hard to pitch something like this when it hasn't been done very often before. And so people didn't understand what the value of it would be. In fact, like, I think on GOG, like, Aladdin had maybe sold, it's been there for a long time, that and Lion King collectively maybe sold like 5,000 units or something when you do the math. And it's just like, people thought we were crazy, but our thesis was that people would like to see this final version. And with all the context that we like to do, we were going to go out and try to find everything we possibly could about these games, put it together, because these games were a big part of people's lives, and they're very interesting people. And the story of the games is even more interesting, because over the years, you would hear stories about the Lion King breakfast that Disney had at like E3 or CES or whatever it was, and all these things. So it's like, what if we just pull all that context, pull it together, tell that story, introduce the final cut of Aladdin, and then interview the team members and all stuff. So it was like, it was hitting every pillar of what we were setting out to do. So it was that in hand, and Nighthawk and Disney, who, after kind of hearing what we thought was a terrible pitch, really got it and said, you know what, this actually does sound great, and put the full force of their companies behind it too. So we collectively pulled this thing together. And all the while just thinking like, let's just see if there's enough people out there. And sure enough, I mean, it did great. It did really well.
When it's,
the operative words here is source code, right? Because like you kind of have to have that if you're because this is not a ROM hack. This is like literally, you know, going back in and then recompiling. And I mean, having source code also was what enabled us to do what we did with Blizzard Arcade Collection, which is, you know, that didn't really get as much like attention and traction as some other games like Cowabunga Collection did. But it's like these our engineers, Mike included, you know, were able to, because Blizzard had source for Lost Vikings and Blackthorn and Rock and Roll Racing, were able to go in and do things like, oh, presenting the games in widescreen and adding Super Metroid style map functionality to Blackthorn and stuff like that. And that's not something we can do without that innate understanding essentially of like what exactly is going on at any given time within the software.
Yeah, and following that final cut thought was like, because I personally was on Rock and Roll Racing, I was able to put the Genesis and Super Nintendo tracks together in one game and put in the CD audio of the actual music, and then also introduce a four-player mode, all because we had source code.
Yeah. There was a really fun time though for a good like week there when people kept talking about Rock and Roll Racing on Genesis has extra tracks, and people kept saying extra tracks, and like half the people were talking about musical tracks and the other half of people were talking about race tracks, and it took us a while before we put it all in. It just took us a while before we realized we were talking about two different things.
The pipe dream for me with that collection was which you did was to put the extra levels of Lost Vikings in with the Super Nintendo controls, and that can't have been easy. It's the kind of thing where I'd say like, oh, that would be a nice thing to happen, and it will never happen, but now it just happens. So now I just, unfortunately, you've made it so that I just assume you're going to always do the things that I want you to do, and so far you have, so you know,
it's hard, but like now we have that bar we have to hit all the time.
I mean, do you ever feel like, I mean, I saw a review of the Blizzard Arcade Collection that said something along the lines of too much sundry content distracts from the stuff that's worth playing. And I just thought, that is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard on one hand. But on the other, do you ever feel like the effort that's going into these isn't quite getting appreciated enough?
Yeah, a little bit. Sometimes it's the audience. We said years ago that this wasn't going to, I think Frank said it. This wasn't going to be an overnight success story.
It's not a condemnation of the audience. It's more just like, you know, sorry, I just want to make that clear. Obviously, it's not. Yeah.
No, absolutely. But like the thing is, we figured that if we do enough of these, people will start to appreciate what these things mean and the value of them. And I think we went from nobody even knowing who we were like 6 years ago to, you hear a lot of like, I hope Digital Eclipse is doing this, or I hope it's, they almost use this like an adjective sometimes. And I think it's only because they started to learn, like our audience started to understand the value of all this context. And we've had a few people now, and some reviews start off where the collection is fantastic. I've been playing it, or I've been in it for like, you know, 4 hours and I haven't even touched a game yet. And it's like, that's amazing. Yeah. That means we're starting to get the validation. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of fed into what we wanted to do with Atari 50, which is we've always felt that the museum is the game, the bonus content is the game. And so it's like, well, how do we really do that? How do we actually take that stuff and get it out of the sidelines or the marginalia of the options menu or the bonus content menu, and actually like integrate that into the player experience? And how do we trust that players are gonna respond to that? Because it's like, it's kind of a risk, because what if most people actually don't bother with any of that stuff and they just want to play the games and they've never even thought about it? So it's really like Atari, you know, having to, you know, make sure that like Atari was on board with this as well. It's just this idea that like, no, we actually think people that are playing this are actually like, you know, they really want all of this content, so let's like integrate this all into like one experience.
Yeah, and I hope it's like a really good documentary. Like, I don't know how many people thought Helvetica would be a great story to tell about the creation of Helvetica, but like I've seen the documentary 3 times now. So it's one of those things where it's like, if we do it right, if we can kind of excite people about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
On a sort of similar note, with, for example, Disney Classics again, the inclusion of, because I've seen a criticism of like the inclusion of, say, like Game Boy Aladdin, Game Boy Lion King, because like it's fair to say that when you compare them to the console versions, they are, you know, broadly speaking, they're less feature packed, they're less air quotes good than the home console ones, but they're always there as an option. And I just wonder if there's ever any kind of inclination or sort of pressure to not include them, or just to stick with what, you know, the, again, air quotes, sort of superior versions of the games.
Yeah, you know what, that does happen, but I think we look at this from various angles. I'm sure Chris has some opinions on this too, where there's the completionist thing of like, see every version of this thing because we're telling the story of a series of games. There's also the personal connection people have with various versions of the game. Some people only played the Game Boy version and that sort of thing. So you want to also do that. But then there's the educational side of it that I'm always fascinated with, is like, what are the differences between, and what sacrifices had to be made for the portable games or other versions of games? Like, for instance, we have Food Fight in the Atari 50th anniversary collection, and we have the arcade game. We have the Atari 800 version of the game. We could have included the Atari 7800 version, which is very close to the arcade game, but we felt it was a stronger thing to demonstrate how the home port of the Food Fight, how different it was and the challenges it had. And so from that perspective, it's interesting to see that. And I think there's something there that's part of the story. If you think of Pac-Man, if we could have put Pac-Man in there, yes, the difference between arcade Pac-Man and Atari Pac-Man would have been great.
And to talk about like with Food Fight for the XE line, because again, if we were to just sort of take all these games and just put them into a list, you know, you'd see, Food Fight for the computer, sure. But it really wasn't released technically for the computers. It was released for the Atari XE game system that came out in the late 80s. That gives us that opportunity to talk about that and to say, this was a game that was only released for this sort of reconfiguring of the Atari computer platform, weirdly and oddly, into this game system. Exactly. And so from a historical context standpoint, it's actually really important to put that there and that also talk about like, well, what was it actually? And then it's a weird thing to say, but like the actual experience of then going in and playing that game can almost become even a secondary reason for having it in there in the first place. It's there as a historical artifact to help tell the story of Atari. If Disney Classic Games Collection didn't exist and we were starting it like today from scratch, it would be a very different project proposal. I can tell you that. And it would be like, yes, of course we got to put these Game Boy games in there, but let's do more, you know, to show people like, this was the process. This is how people had to take this console game and translate it into a portable game. Let's talk about the fact that for some people, their parents didn't allow them to own game consoles, but they didn't count the Game Boy as being a game console. So they put 1,000 hours into Aladdin on the Game Boy. And we talk about it that way. And then again, the hope is when people get that context, they're like, oh, that's cool. Let me check this out. And then when they start playing it, they're like, oh, yeah, they're right. Yeah, it's interesting how they kind of took this element and did it that way. Huh, this game is pretty neat. And so instead of bonus thing no one will ever play, it becomes something that people actually like can appreciate and get into.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like what we do all the time with these, is like, how do we get people to appreciate everything we have in here?
Yep.
Of course, I mean, all the British kids will be sitting there going, where's Master System Aladdin? Why is that not in here?
Yeah.
But, something's got to give, I guess. Although I have to say, of course, patching in, adding DLC for the Jungle Book games plus SNES Aladdin, I have to ask how that got wrangled, because obviously I'd have thought it would have been included initially if it was possible then. But I don't know what happened to make that possible.
I'd say the hardest thing about everything we do outside of like, obviously there's a lot of, you know, hard work that goes into these productions and things like that. But I think like the more challenging thing that we don't just control by hard work is licensing and cooperation of IP holders. And so when we do these things, a lot of people own various aspects of these games, and that might not get done in time for what we need to do. We can't be on these things where like we may be negotiating from day one and still never get to a resolution on some of the stuff we want to include. We've even had situations where we've included things and we find out like the day before we ship that there's rights problems. We have to pull them out and do an update and all these things. Like this stuff just happens all the time. And with the Disney collection, I think it did a few things. We proved that it was a viable product that could sell well. And then also there were negotiations that were going on that just never came to conclusion by the time it shipped that were able to come together as well. And so doing that kind of follow on that's more of a complete version of that was something we wanted from the very beginning. Everybody wanted from the very beginning, but it took that time to get there. And because it did well, it proved that we could do it.
And again, as you said, it's like that first whack at, you know, the Disney, the Aladdin and the Lion King, that was being done when it was kind of like, you think these are going to sell? People are going to buy this? Mm. And so, but now it's like doing that update. It's like we've now proven that people are actually going to buy it. And so it makes more sense to go and start paying money licensing essentially something like Capcom and for the Capcom version of Aladdin, which again, like I'm super excited to have in there. I really like that.
It's great. It's the same for me with the inclusion of the second Lost Vikings game in the Blizzard collection, which came out about, I want to say, a few weeks after it launched. So that was really exciting, I thought. Nice that it was, you know, because you could just have not done that, you know? You could have just not put Snez Aladdin in. You could have just not put Jungle Book in.
We would probably be much more profitable if we didn't do these things, but we also wouldn't live with ourselves if we didn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to sleep at night.
Exactly.
It's all the long game. It's all the long game. Eventually, it's going to come back and benefit us. It hasn't happened yet, but, you know, eventually.
We'll get there. Yeah, we hope so.
Talking of Atari 50, I think I found it interesting. Now, just to explain briefly, even though people by now will know that the timeline aspect of Atari 50 is a presentation of the sort of Atari timeline with contextual video clips, trivia, and artwork, and, you know, playable games, and sort of other sort of errata. What I thought was quite interesting about it, and very, very rare in a product like this, is it didn't really shy away from some of sort of Atari's missteps and maybe mistakes, which has it's kind of almost sort of a warts and all kind of feel, because games like Cybermorph, the Jaguar title Cybermorph, and then that's not even getting into Jaguar being on there at all, but we'll get to that. I mean, the only reason, or not the only reason, but the primary reason I would say that's a known at all is because of a very funny Angry Video Game Nerd video trashing it. So I wonder, again, if there was ever any kind of suggestion, maybe don't include that stuff and you just focus on the sort of the positive aspects, but then I suppose it wouldn't be true, would it?
Go ahead, Chris. I'll let you.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, so Atari, like, you know, today's Atari was very amenable to the idea of like, yeah, we're going to talk about, like, you know, mistakes and the clash of corporate cultures and stuff like that, because I mean, they're so far removed from it. They're not offended by that at all. You know, so they actually thought that, you know, having that conflict in there would actually help this to stand out. I mean, one of the things that Atari in particular was like, they realized there are already Atari collections out there, you know, on modern platforms that you can go buy. This had to be something different. And so that was a way of differentiating it. And it's not done in a way where we sort of like point and laugh at ET or something like that. You know what I mean? It's all done with a human angle. We understand the decisions that went into it. You know, the video interviews are constructed in a certain way so that you understand, you know, sort of the mistakes that were made. And it's done in a sympathetic sort of a way. And as far as there was, I remember there was a little bit of a pushback when we were trying to pick out Jaguar games, and I'm like, oh, Club Drive. And somebody from Atari was like, oh, that reviewed really poorly back in the day. And I'm like, doesn't matter. Like, it just, it's like that's like the least of my concerns at this point. It's like, because again, it's about that, like, you know, the historical importance of it. And just the fact that it's like Club Drive. It's like, it was, I never want to say the first anything, but it was like a game where you can kind of drive anywhere you want, fully constructed out of polygons. You know, it is a fascinating historical artifact today to go back and look at, for sure. Yeah. And so I'm so glad we have it in there. Then it turns out, again, there's Club Drive fans out there. There's Drive heads, you know, who just love this game. And so, like, we're happy to give that to them as well.
And on top of that, like, it's kind of our approach now whenever we begin discussions with any partner on these sorts of things, where we say from the very get-go, and you can hear me talk about documentaries all the time on this thing, but like we approach it with this very objective documentarian kind of viewpoint, where it doesn't it isn't about putting it in a good light or a bad light. It's about just telling the objective story of it and like finding out what that narrative is and then going all in on that. So if there's bad moments, good moments, I think it's, we want to be impartial to that. So we're not trying to like pump up a company's value of these games. We're not trying to do whatever that, if that's a side effect, great. But ultimately what we want to do is give all that. And we've used this word so many times as well, like all that context to somebody who's never experienced this stuff before. So we have a lot of people who've never really played Atari Jaguar, even Atari home computers or Atari 7800, or, and now even more people interested who've never even played a 2600 collection, which boggles my mind, coming in because they want to under, they kind of want to go on this journey of 50 years for Atari, not necessarily because of the games in particular.
And you mentioned, you know, the angry video game nerd. And it's also like, yeah, you know, so many games. So, I mean, the Jaguar is certainly one, you know, certainly or Ninja Turtles 1 on the NES, you know, it becomes a meme and it becomes nothing else. And so with Ninja Turtles 1, you could always go back, get an emulator, play it and experience it for yourself. But again, like, you know, with Cowabunga Collection, it was like, what can we do to kind of rehabilitate this game's, you know, this the Ninja Turtles 1 is a really good game with the difficulty cranked up too high. You know, so it's just like, give people the tools, rewind just makes that game brilliant, because like what happens in Turtles 1 is that like, you're just going along and everything is actually fine. And then suddenly the game kind of like assaults you with like, bam, 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 the turtle's dead. I'm sorry, captured. And so, but just to be able to just say, okay, hold up. Let me just rewind 5 seconds back to when I had full health. Let me try that again. It just makes it so much more pleasant to play through and then experience what was actually, you know, good about that design. This is not to say that it's not, I mean, everybody got frustrated with this game, you know, and sort of like watching the angry video game nerd video is very cathartic to the shared experience that we had. But for us, it's like, how do we rehab the game? And so, Jaguar is another example, because even if you wanted to just go on the internet and try to find some Jaguar ROMs in an emulator and emulate them, you basically couldn't, because the state of Atari Jaguar emulation was such that it was sort of patchy and piecemeal and nothing really worked that well. Now we have this internal coded from scratch Jaguar emulator. And now you can actually, people, again, they know Jaguar, the meme of the Jaguar. They do not actually, they have not played the games, because unless you want to spend $500 on an Atari Jaguar and start buying actual cartridges for like obscene prices, you cannot actually experience the Jaguar. And so now we're actually letting people do that. And you can get that hands-on experience for yourself and discover, quite frankly, I think that the Jaguar, it, you know, was more than, you know, it than it than the reputation that it has now.
Yeah. And another thing I had learned along these lines a few years back now is I had helped out and was participating in this documentary called Atari Game Over. And when it started, when it first came across the email and I got invited to participate in this thing, it was intended to be a mockumentary. Like, they weren't planning on doing a real documentary on the ET burial site. And it was only after like a few weeks of more people coming on board that the real story started to kind of come through about Howard's struggle to get that game out, what really happened at Atari, that ultimately it moved from being something that pokes fun at ET, which was already done by Angry Video Game Nerd and everything anyway, to this really like sympathetic and character-driven story about Howard Scott Warshaw, and a redemption arc came out of it. And so the result of that ended up being a lot of people's interest in ET wasn't like because it was a terrible game. Did the documentary prove it? No. It's still a bad game, but that new perspective of around ET resulted in like the prices of the game going up, getting it's harder to find. People wanted to have it. People wanted to experience it. People were going to try out ET because of the story behind it. And that was something that just after that, seeing that effect is something I feel like we should be like pushing more for. It's like, tell that again, coming back to context, but putting that all in there is super valuable and exciting for people. I think people are really interested in that, and it makes the games more interesting to play.
And also with ET, when you see the problem, I mean, I think a lot of the problem with ET, not to get into, you know, this, but it's not in the collection, but you know, ET kids, they get it for Christmas and they rip the wrapper off and then they rip the box in half and they rip the manual in half and they throw it all in the garbage and they put the game in and they're like, okay, here we go. It's ET. And they have no idea what to do. And so the thing is, ET, not only they knew that ET was like too complicated because they included not only an instruction manual with ET, but then like a fold out sheet that like had even more tips that weren't in the instruction manual. And it's like,
wow.
If for your first game of ET, you know, set the settings to these settings so it's the easiest mode, and then you can understand how to play ET. And when you do that, when you go in with an open mind and you RTFM and you actually like play the game like as the manual tells you to, and you understand how it plays, is it a great game? No, but is it like a completely incomprehensible game? No, but you have to like read that. And so that's like why we always make sure, you know, to include the information that you are going to need. We don't just dump you with an Atari 2600 ROM and say, figure it out. You know, we give you, we make sure you have that manual like to hand because you need it.
And in some instances, we even have helpers that show up on screen while you play these games now. You don't even have to go to the manual, but make sure you have the information you need to continue to play it correctly.
Star Raiders, right?
Yeah, Star Raiders is a good example.
You should talk about that because I think that's something that we haven't really talked about a lot.
Well, yeah. Like, so Star Raiders and the Atari 50th, the I would say the killer app for the Atari 800, and then ultimately the best version of the Atari 5200 version with analog. We were including that, but one of the challenges in previous collections and just historically has been that exact thing that Chris described. If you don't have the manual, you have no idea how to play the game. There is just no way to just start that game and know what to do. And not only that, it had keyboard control functions and all stuff that don't really map well to a controller. So when we're putting Star Raiders in here, like you realize this is such an important game that no one will touch because it's impossible to figure out. So we should include the original, but we should also do a number of quality of life things to make this a very understandable game. So we basically hacked the game, went through the source, rewrote aspects of the game to make sure that it plays well on a controller, but also gave you the ability to have all the information you needed to have, because the game required you to kind of keep mentally track of how many enemies are in the sector that I'm in and how many, what's damaged, like what's my damage state on things. So we created this bezel around the game that gives you all those indicators that are active and live indicators. We also offer an overclock mode because the game is really slow. Back in the day, it was very forgiving, but now it was really hard for our testers, our teenage testers, we always call them, to really comprehend, like, why is it so slow? This game is so slow. So we made it so you can lock in like 30 frames a second. It just stays consistent. We've added additional audio. We put rumble support in. We put all these things in. And when you go to like the galactic map, it tells you what you need to do and how to do it rather than having to go back to the manual to do that. So we walk you through the brilliance of this game. And we don't necessarily change anything in the game. We changed the interface to make it feel more like it felt for somebody playing the game for the first time back in the day when everything outside of Star Raiders is even more complicated. So Star Raiders was an easy thing to understand back then because like it was a miracle that all this stuff was coming together. But hindsight, it doesn't work for people today. So we're able to go and kind of recreate that first impression and also make the game more accessible to people. And since then, like it was amazing to watch our testers go from I don't know what I'm doing to trying to get the best ranking in the game and competing. And it was just awesome to see that.
I think that accessibility and, as Chris mentioned, Rewind, for example, is important, if only to, and I'm trying to think of a good way to describe this. It helps to give those games sort of more, again, context and value, because there seem to be a period, and it's sort of ongoing, where old video games aren't perceived to have any value because you can just download them. Mm-hmm. But now here, of course, you've got sort of quality and quantity. So you've got something like, I want to say 100 or so games in Atari 50. There's a lot in there, but none of those games are just slapped on there. Like, here you go nuts. As you've talked about, it's all presented in not only historical context, but you know, with the manual, so actual context as well. And I think that's something to appreciate. I don't know. Obviously, when I think of the VCS, the 2600, I do think of Activision, and they are acknowledged in the museum, and I wondered if there was any sort of effort made to include any of the Activision games at all, or if that just wasn't the focus this time.
We were really focused on Atari-owned properties, but that didn't mean that we didn't want like, I think Atari and ourselves would have loved to included those. I think you also look at this moment in time with Activision. I don't think it would, I would, without saying too much, as you say, it probably would have been very difficult had we pursued it to try to include it this time around in this. Like, that doesn't, you know, mean that we can't talk to Activision later and try to do something or whatever, but it would have been amazing to include it. And that's why we at least make mention in the timeline about it, but it was just not going to be in the cards for this go round.
It makes
sense. Again, a lot of things. So a lot of the stuff we did in the timeline, as you may have noticed, is like, well, why can't we mention Activision? We can mention Activision, right? Like, we can't put an Activision game in here, but like, we can talk about it. I mean, it's part of the story. So let's just talk about it. Let's take a photograph of some titles of some games and do it that way. Just because, again, you can't understand the arc of Atari and what happened without also understanding that, you know, what was going on internally at Atari caused a whole bunch of people to quit. I mean, it is a story about labor. It's a story about, you know, management versus labor and, you know, money versus art and all this kind of stuff comes into it. And it's this story that is going to resonate with people in today's world, because it's a lot of the same struggles. And so it's like, if you, you know, and again, we can't do it all in a video game. Like, there's only so much text on a screen somebody will sit there and read, you know. It has to be, the timelines really had to be artifact focused. There are some boxes that are just text just to get us through that kind of part in the story. But like, we really tried to write it very short, make it very compact, because nobody's going to sit there and just scroll through paragraphs and paragraphs of text. And so we can't cover everything, but I think it would be fun if people were like, oh, I got the bare bones, or I got the skeleton of this story from playing Atari 50. And now I'm reading Atari history books because I want to fill in all the gaps and get everything. So if you want to learn more about Atari, go visit your local library.
Yep.
Now, as well as the sort of various different Atari systems, you've got, I want to say, six new games in there, or reimaginings of games, such as there's a new version of Haunted House, there's Near Breakout, there's Vector Sector, there was another, a combat-like game, the name temporarily escapes me. Now, I've got to ask how those all came about, because I had a lot of fun with those as well.
That's another one of those discussions we've been having for a while of basically what could we do to kind of celebrate or explore more of a brand identity. And one of the things that we love to do, because we love making games, but it's like, it's one thing to port games over, enhance games, but it's also great to kind of wear the shoes of the people who preceded us and try to understand the difficulties and stuff. Like, it's kind of its own kind of education for us and for those who are playing these games. So we were playing over the idea of what would it be like if we could do some sort of mashups or improvements over some of the games that we enjoy, that we grew up with, that were important to us. What would that look like? And I think that's kind of where it came from. It was more or less like a meeting of like, who wants to work on what? And so everybody who was working on these games, myself included, with Quadra Tank is the name that escaped you.
Right. Yes. Yeah, sorry.
No problem. That was my game. How dare you? So we just want to do things that we loved. And so like with Quadra Tank, I wanted to just capture the amount of fun I had with my friends playing combat. I felt like I was always my friends and I were always the outliers, because like, we liked combat. It was multiplayer and we did tournaments and all stuff. And that kind of moved into doing stuff with like playing Bomberman the same way and playing all those other multiplayer games. Yeah. It became like part of my career where I kept working on multiplayer games and enjoying that aspect of it. Jeremy Williams, who did Vector Sector, a huge fan of vector games, that became his call to arms. And then we had Dave Reese, who was a huge fan of Haunted Houses, and Jason Cirillo, who is probably the biggest breakout fan I've ever met. And, it's an Air World being something that we knew, if you're going into 50 years of Atari, it felt like that had to be part of this, because that's it's an unfinished quest. And so many people fantasize what that fourth game would have been like. And so we also wanted to deliver that. And so Dave Reese, who did our Haunted Houses game, jumped on top of that too. So it was really just our way of, it's our love letters to the creators of these games and these genres, in Atari. And that's kind of how it came together. Like, Jason loved, the Touch Me, the little handheld Touch Me. That's one of his favorite things. And so he's like, I'm going to put it in the collection because nobody's done it. And so he went for it. And so we didn't want to hold back on that. We also had timelines we had to hit. So we kind of, we reduced the scope of the things we want to do. Like you can imagine, we probably said, let's do like 50 of these things or whatever. But so what's in there was just what we could also deliver in the time, but we felt that we could do at least a competent enough job or at least a nice homage to those games.
Yeah. I thought when I played Quadratank, I was, cause I only played it with myself so far. I did find myself thinking I'm going to need to get this on next time I get together with some people. It seems like it would be a laugh. I love the twin stick controls. I think they're absolutely great.
You know how many people hated that? It was so funny. Like in testing, people are like, this is the worst controls I've ever. I'm like, this is the real tank controls. You do have the alternate controls. You can play it like combat. You can play it.
You can,
but like, I love the tank controls.
I just want to stick with those till I get used to them because they're just so fun. With Vector Sector, I got to say, I was just when the sort of the blurb screen for it says it's a take on Lunar Lander and Asteroids, and then I kept playing it, and it's like, oh no, this is Major Havoc now. Oh, now it's Tempest. Like that was enormous fun. Just, I mean, that's where I lost all my lives on Tempest. So I don't know if it then becomes something else, but I'll keep plugging away at it. Thank you on a personal level. Thank you for putting Major Havoc in this because that's my favorite.
Over the years, the last probably like during the pandemic, particularly when we were talking about doing this or anything like that, like I fell so in love with Major Havoc. I always liked it. But the thing that we wanted to solve was the controls, because like it is so hard to control. I had that horizontal spinner, and so much time and effort went into make sure that felt right, and putting in at least some more options of that. But also visually and the audio, we want to make sure we're really dead on. So there was a lot of effort put into making that be fully represented. We even had Owen Rubin come in, who worked on the original, and kind of give us some pointers on where we were on some aspects of the game to make sure it was just as tight as it could be. And I love that game so much. That's the one I probably play the most on the collection right now, outside of Vector Sector, which I love.
I think that was one I discovered on some old Atari compilation, one of the ones that was like, I think it was like 80 games in one. I think you might have worked on that actually back in the day. that had Major Havoc on there, I believe. And it was just a moment of like, well, I've never heard of this. How good can it be? And then getting into it for like 3 hours. One thing I appreciated again is, and this is something that only recently seems to have been realized by such sort of compilations, is you got the kind of phosphorescence of the glow of the vectors quite well done. Because a lot of times I'd play Asteroids on a compilation and it would just be the plain vector lines. And you're like, why would anyone want to look at this? And then when I played it on an actual Asteroids like cocktail cabinet a few years ago, I was like, oh, I see, because it's the gorgeous glowing, flashing, like beautiful lights. That's what's so cool about the vectors. And you don't get that. You didn't used to get that without having actual hardware. And now that is actually being emulated to an extent, which I think is great.
We always found vectors mesmerizing. Like they just, they look just so different from everything else. And so we spent a lot of time, Jeremy Williams, who did Vector Sector, he basically explored how to get the vectors to look right with that game and then adapted that over to the other games. And also having Owen Rubin and others from Atari come in and discuss how, like what the natural state of what they expected from vectors to look like and what they did, the tricks they had done to draw things on screen, and having that realization that those tricks weren't accurately being represented in the game. So we had to like kind of go back to the well several times to figure out like, how do we get those perfectly represented? Like the random color effects in Major Havoc are very particular, and there's a distribution of those colors that make the things look like they do in the arcade. So we had to do that. And then if you look at something like Asteroids Deluxe, late in the game, we realized like the parallaxed cardboard that the screen would reflect over wasn't really being captured either. So we scanned and separated all the layers of the asteroid effect, like the dressing, and we put a subtle parallax effect on there like you would have at the arcade, and we tracked the asteroid ship as it moves across the screen to use that as your perspective to move the parallaxing a bit so that there's some movement aligned to something that's going on screen. And it's so subtle, most people don't even pick it up, but for those who know, they really know. And we've already got some response from people thinking like that was a great effect to include.
That is pretty. See, I didn't realize that, but I'm going to keep an eye out for that next time. next time I launch it, I have a few sort of questions left that are just kind of more sort of frivolous bonus questions, I guess I call them. on the subject of Atari 50, for both of you, was there a game that you discovered in the process of putting this together that you now have sort of fallen in love with?
Chris, you go first.
Nothing that I sort of discovered anew, but I love that we've got Tempest 2000 in there. Like, I'm really excited to be able to get that in there. I mean, that was, I just remember going to KB toy stores back in the day after the prices had all collapsed on the Jaguar stuff, and buying a Jaguar for $20 and Tempest 2000 for $10, because all I'd ever heard about the Jaguar is, this is the killer app, this is the game you got to play. And it was like tremendous, right? It was just so much fun. And so to have it in there, to have it emulated properly, to really finally have that, that authentic experience is like, definitely go play Tempest 2000. It's great. I also played not a lot of Club Drive, but I played, like an hour just messing around in Club Drive. And I think it's just so cool. I think it's just so interesting. Also, I will absolutely say that with beyond a doubt, Trevor McFur in the Crescent Galaxy is the second best shooter with an anthropomorphic furry hero that was released in 1993.
Well, Chris definitely took my Tempest 2000 answer, which is fine, because I think that's what a lot of people say. Just like every time I boot it up, I tend to just follow the habit trail straight to Tempest 2000 and start playing. but outside of that, I reacquainted myself and fell in love with Miner 2049er all over again. And we had to modify that game because it had keyboard controls for certain levels. And so while I was doing all that work, I also added a fast forward button, because most of the time in that game, you're just walking and there's nothing you're doing because it's a lot of level to traverse. So by adding that fast forward button, it doesn't ruin anything. You know, the time speeds up, everything speeds up. So you can actually just play it the way you want to play it. And so I ended up playing a lot of Miner 2049er just for the fun of it, with some of these quality of life features on top. So I love that one. And then on the Jaguar, I'd say I had always made fun of back in the day, Cybermorph. I take it back, not entirely, but I take most of it back, because I end up spending a lot of time playing Cybermorph for some reason I can't explain, other than it must have been fun.
It's just kind of cool and interesting, I guess I would say. And Miner 2049er has got to be up there in the Game Titles Hall of Fame. That's an absolute classic.
Yeah, it's great. And the sequel is good.
Yeah, what's it called again?
Bounty Bob Strikes Back.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, yeah.
You don't have to pay $1,000 to get it.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I mean, I personally found myself, I'm not going to pretend I hadn't played it before, but I got pretty into Ninja Golf. I really like Ninja Golf.
Oh, yeah. You know, that you bring that up, like that one, I had the benefit of having that one for years. That's one of the games I always pull out when people want, like, ask, like, what's cool on the 7800? It's like, you got to check out Ninja Golf. But I also worked with one of the gentlemen who worked on this guy, David Sullivan, who told me a lot of the funny stories about it. And I think Retro Gamer covered the story on it or something like that. But it was funny that Atari went to the team and said, here's a list of like genres and games we want to do. And there was ninjas, golf or whatever. They're just like, all right, ninja and golf, let's do it. kind of together. And David Sullivan, he told me stories about how they would trace over Karateka frames. So the reason the guy looks like the Karateka is because they're big Karateka fans. They're like, how do you draw a ninja? Like, well, let's just trace this one.
That's outstanding. I think I played it on the Lynx. It came out on the Lynx, I think. And it might be where I played it. I might be completely wrong.
I don't know that it came out on the Lynx, but
it must have been the 7800 one that I played then.
I love a Ninja Golf Mandela effect. I think we just gotta propagate that.
Okay, I exist in the universe where it did come out on the Lynx, and also the Lynx was way more successful than the crappy little Game Boy.
Exactly, that's the world I live in.
Something else I want to ask, which again, this is something that's difficult to ask because you may well be in the process of doing this. If you had like a sort of pipe dream compilation you'd like to work on, what would that be?
All right. So picture this. So the phone rings. It's early in the morning. I blearily kind of like grab it from my nightstand. I answer the phone. It's Miyamoto. And then Chris, I played Atari 50 and it's incredible. You are the second best game designer on earth. We need you to do for Nintendo what you did for Atari. And I'm like, yes, of course, Miyamoto-san, we'd be happy to. I wake up in a cold sweat and they want to go back to the dream, but I can't. I mean, yeah, that's the if you want to ask me what the dream project is, that's it. I mean, otherwise, there's just so much out there. There's so many great games out there. And I think that, with Cowabunga Collection and now Atari 50 soon to be kind of behind us and out there for people to see you know, what it is we're trying to do here, that I do think that we're going to get the opportunity to work on great stuff in the future. And I'm ready for whatever it is.
Yeah. Of course, Nintendo would be probably the biggest collection we could potentially ever do. There's so much that like we could probably mine to put in there. But if I throw all that away and I can't talk about stuff we're currently working on, then there's the dumb stuff that I really enjoy. And like one of those things that I've always wanted to do was make a collection of all the fake games and movies. So like Starfighter, Superman 3, The Simpsons games, like was it Lee Trevino or no, or was that the real one? Whatever the golf game was.
Lee Carvello's putting challenge.
Yeah. Like all those
Bone Storm.
Put Bone Storm in there. Maybe it's just a Simpsons collection of all their fake games.
That'd be. Yep. But, I mean, I'd like to see a Simpsons collection of the actual Simpsons games. To be honest,
They should let us do that. That's a really they should call us immediately.
There's a guy online I saw who did a really incredible take on Waterworld, the game from Simpsons. Yeah, which I was like, that's amazing too. Now, for the record, we've been talking about the Simpsons thing for a long time, but I felt like he fulfilled the dream somewhat. And but yeah, that would be my dream thing. It's like there's this movie called Nightmares that had a sequence that had Emilio Estevez in it. It was called The Bishop of Battle. I would love to do that game because it was like this crazy vector game. Been wanting to do that for a while too. So it's like, imagine collecting all these up in like one big collection and just talk to all the production designers and then fans who were just like, one day I was hoping I would ever play this game, which would be me basically on camera, I guess, but it'd be fun.
Now you got me thinking, I just want to see the 8 and 16 bit Simpsons games in the compilation.
Because like you will probably never be able to get the actual Simpsons games or without a lot of effort, but let's just make these games.
but now I'm thinking about the idea of having Bart versus the Space Mutants with an overlay that tells you how to play it. That'd be something, and actual good controls as well. Man, that'd be wild.
If anybody listening like knows what happened to the rights to those games, like give us a call.
Yeah.
Get in touch with Stu, care of Retronauts, and he'll pass the message on to us because we don't.
Absolutely.
I'll pass it on the condition that I get brought in some capacity.
Okay. Pay for it all, and Stu will be co-producer. We're good to go.
And I guess, I mean, other than The Simpsons, I'm going to give you my one anyway, which is that I'd really like to see an equivalent Sega collection, but for the Mickey and Donald games. And I get that comes up a lot. Because that's a real, you know, the illusion, Castle of Illusion, World of Illusion, all that stuff. That would be fantastic.
Right.
That's my dream one.
All right. I'm writing it down. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, go. Please make that. Please cancel anything else that you're doing and just do that. So I guess finally, how, Mike, because I think based on my research that I did you work on the Midway Arcade Treasures back in the PS2, Xbox kind of?
I did a bit.
I was just sort of wondering how you feel that the kind of retro gaming has changed since the way those games were perceived back then and the way they'd be perceived now, really.
This goes back a little bit to some of the stuff we were talking about before we started with like Mega Man Legacy Collection and the things we wanted to do there. If you go back to really early days, Digital Eclipse, we had done like we did the first commercial emulation with like Joust Defender and Robotron on the Mac. And then following up on that, we had done a PlayStation Midway collection. And at that time, we thought the best thing we could do, not only to put those games in, which were only 10 years old at that time, now to think back.
Oh, like, God, yeah, now that you mention it, yeah.
It was crazy to think it was only in 10 years, but like we had the forethought to try to do some video interviews with the guys who created the games, because they're all still at Midway. So it's like, hey, we have this opportunity. So we did that, and it had come out, and people really liked it, but I don't think people appreciated that as much as they do now. And as a result, the later games we would work on, like Midway included, and other companies we work with, like Activision and whatnot, like they basically said, like, oh, we don't need those interviews on stuff. That's just an expense we don't need to add to it because it doesn't move the needle. And I think that was because the games were still relatively not, I mean, they were 10 years old, not that old. Like there was just no like need or sense of a need for, you know, gathering those stories just yet. But we've always wanted to do it. And we felt like every collection we would do, we would get beat up on the don't do all this extra stuff. People only care about the games. They only care about the games. And so it was really hard to get to that moment where we could finally sell people on the value well stuff. And I think it's really come down to, as I'm speaking here, just spitballing with all you guys here, don't tell anybody. No, just kidding. I think because the games are so accessible, that like what you were saying earlier, where there's other ways to play these games,
yes,
that for those who appreciate these games or are interested in the story of these games, that is the new value. It isn't just people are just buying this to play the games. They're not. I think now people are buying it to either have the quality of life improvements on these games so they can play them like and have the same feeling and appreciation they had for these games before, or somebody coming in new can play them and not feel like these are just like junky old games. Yeah. Like having all this extra stuff here is the value. It's not necessarily just the games themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, going from sort of almost quantity to more towards quality, because I remember the PS2 stuff would have something like Taito Legends, which had something like 55 games on it, and some of them were just broken, like because the controls weren't right. You couldn't finish them. But there were so many, which is like, oh, gee, Darius, who cares? But no, I mean, I think what you're doing is good, and it's helping to alleviate my frustration when people say like, oh, I'm not paying $5-6 for Super Mario Brothers 3, which makes me want to kill them. I never know how to end these things, so I just say thank you very much for doing this. I've enjoyed it immensely. Hopefully we will speak again in some capacity at some point, maybe if you do Atari 100 at some point. But I guess
we have your wish list, so we're going to get to work on making all those games you want. You know, it's funny because you did say like as when Blizzard Arcade Collection came out, it was like, oh, this would be a 10 out of 10 if they had Lost Vikings 2 and RPM racing in there. And of course, at that point, we knew they were going to go in. It was just a matter of timing that had to be it was going to be in an update. You know, so I'm like,
I mentioned it to Mike on Twitter. Actually, I sort of said, oh, it's a sort of a shame they're not in there. And his response was
right. Yeah,
that's the worst because we put these games out and people are like, I wish it had this or whatever, and it's like, we may have already submitted that, but we can't say anything just yet because you know, there's a lot of reasons for not being able to say everything we want to say. But like, it that's like one of the worst parts is like people make these criticisms even before, like on Atari 50th, there's all these criticisms people were putting on Twitter before they even knew what it was and complaining about like, they won't talk about this, they won't talk about that, whatever. And it's like, and we had all that stuff in there. And we're like, they'll find out. They'll find out we're going to talk about all of that stuff. Yeah, Rob Fulop getting just the turkey. Yeah, you're going to find out about that.
Right.
I've thought of the perfect thing to end with, actually. Now, there's 6 new games in Atari 50, and there are 6 locked games in Atari 50. Now, one of them, spoilers. One of them I unlocked by completing the museum, but the rest of them, one of them is Haunted House. I know that one. I found that we found that one. The rest of them are a mystery, so I got to ask you for a hint on at least one of them.
I'd say for Quadratank, which is the only one I really know off the top of my head, play around with, like rockets and controlling rockets around the map are going to be very helpful.
Gotcha. Okay. And these are going to be really hard to find, aren't they? Okay.
Well, you know what? Vector Sector, just get very far in it. Just get to like a later level.
Yeah. You saw the poems, right? The
oh, yes. Yes, poetry. I did. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know,
very nice.
Read those. Stuff. Read those. Think about the. Yes, that was Dan Amrick, the other member of the editorial team, who I know he designs puzzles. I mean, I've known him for a really long time, and I know he's super into puzzles and writing puzzle poems and stuff like that. And so, like, any opportunity, I'm like, Dan, write poetry. And he'll crank it out immediately. And it's like, brilliant. It's like, it's you have to know your team's strengths.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, again, thanks very much, and hopefully we'll see you soon, and I'll be keeping an eye out for everything you're putting out and continuing to be an unabashed fanboy clinging to you like a limpet. Thank you.
We've seen all your stuff. We really appreciate your support on this. We really do.
That's great.
Cool.
Okay. And I'm going to do the bit where we plug things, which I think can be plugged into the end of the episode, perhaps. Okay. So let's plug. Lewis, where can people find you on the internet, please?
So SegaDream.com is the website. All the socials are linked on the main page if you want to follow us on various platforms. There is an accompanying YouTube channel, youtube.com/@SegaDriven. Lots of weird videos about niche Sega stuff. Told by someone who cares, I guess. If you want to follow me personally, I'm on Twitter @KronkBlatz, but I'm not really using it too much at the moment because Twitter is a cesspit. So I've jumped over to Mastodon, and you can find me on there as Sonic Yoda, and I'm on the Mastodon.social instance.
Bloody Mastodon. Every time I'm just like, oh God, forget it. Like, I'm not saying it's horrible or anything. It's just like, I can't get my head around it yet.
For me personally, every time I load up Twitter, I get bombarded with just the absolute worst of the world. And when I go on Mastodon, it feels like a nicer time for my head. So that's generally why I'm using it at the moment.
Well, now that Twitter is being, you know, controlled by, what can I say, a tech genius, it's sure to improve in short term. As for me, I'm Stuart Gipp. You can find me at Stupacabra on Twitter still for the time being. I'm also on co-host under the same name, and I'll probably join Mastodon at some point, and I'll let you know when Twitter collapses. But until then, I'm clinging on with my skin and my teeth, because I love that site, man. I loved it. You can also read my stuff at retronauts.com, and I do a webcomic. It's called Merry Hell. Read Merry Hell. Merryhellcomic.com. It has nothing to do with video games. Cheers.
Good stuff.
And with that, we come to the end of the bit that isn't an interview. So thank you for listening, and I'm not sure if this is going to be edited to the end.